pain is going to go away, and another season of happiness will come. So you must be strong, my brother, and pass our condolences to the family. There's been a couple of apologies. I see Honorable Mabilu is here. There was an apology for him. Honorable Khadebe called me on the way to say that he's still stuck on traffic, like I was also stuck in traffic. The traffic is quite bad. I'm told the train service is not working properly, so everybody else is going to the road. The taxis, and it's also raining outside, so it's quite a bit hectic. as I said, Honorable Mamilu is already here, so Honorable Kekana,
she's also in the way.
Okay. She's coming here. She said she was not going to make it, but she's on her way. And then we've got an apology of Honorable Mabika. He'll be attending another meeting. And okay. All right, and I'm told the minister is on her way. She will be joining us soon. The deputy minister, has apologized. She was deployed over the weekend, and she has to finalize the work, the report, apparently, that she was assigned to do. So she's not going to be able to come. And we've got an apology from the DG that she had prepared to attend the Wednesday meeting. She's preparing for the DG's for ministerial ICT cluster briefing at 10:30, and thereafter at 12:30, she's co-chairing the DG's cluster with the DG of Environment in International Relations and Corporations. So these meetings are pre-scheduled by Cabinet Secretariat and take place monthly on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Okay? So those are the only apologies that we had. I see the department is led by two DDGs. And the officials. So we are going to proceed then with our meeting. Today we wanted to focus on climate change NDCs as well as air quality. So this will be the focus for today's session. I'm told that there is a report that still needs to be presented to the minister on, is it VAL? Yeah, I just want to make sure the minister did communicate the unstudied report, which we thought that we should be briefed on today, so it has not been presented to the minister and the deputy minister. I asked Judy, when was this report done?
Morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. It was concluded last year, and it's one report that is interlinked with a number of other reports, we need to present those.
Okay, last year, when last year?
In July last year.
No, we are in June now. It's almost a year. The minister hasn't seen it. Welcome, minister. So you were here when I gave your apology. Oh, okay. Yeah, that report has not been brought. Okay. We are not going to get that report, but please give that to the minister. If you finalize the report almost a year, and you haven't even presented to the minister, please, there must be a bit of an urgency in the work that you do. Because I'm sure probably that report has got some recommendations. That report, Minister, probably has got recommendations that you need to act on. Yes. That's also our question, you know. Yes. So there must be a sense of urgency when we deal with this kind of things, because it affects people's health. So as soon as it is done, it must be presented to the relevant authorities, to the minister in this instance, and then ultimately to come to us. So it's really unacceptable that the officials can sit with the report for almost a year without it being properly processed. But I'm sure that, it's going to be done, because as soon as some of these things are concluded, it must be. We got to know that there is this report, Minister, and we thought that we needed to be briefed. We were not even aware that you haven't given the report. Okay. Hopefully soon we'll get briefing on it. Can we welcome the minister and we've already welcomed the officials. Over to you, minister, and you tell us who's going to deal with what.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to, first of all, apologize for arriving a minute after you started. I also, as you have said, discussed, undertake to get that report tabled properly, and then we go through it. What the main objective would be really is for me to look at and the Deputy Minister, because she actually coordinates this work of air quality, to look at whether it has impact on other colleagues. Executive Council, because this is actually, once it comes here, it becomes a public document, so that we then take it through those who would need to know about the outcomes, and also be able to react and say how they are able to be taking action. Because as you know, it would probably entail things like source apportionment studies, outcome that could say Mibaula and so forth, because we should be done away with electrification process and so forth, and requires and so forth. So we need that. We need that commitment from other colleagues as well. Hopefully, if it does have those kinds of recommendations. Also, the same applies to when it has recommendations about industry, because there are other colleagues who are dealing with industry, trade and industry, economic development will also have to know about it. Pity that we live in South Africa half the time and half the time external. I think it would have been possible to get this report. Even today, Chair, as I indicated to you, I'm leaving tonight for a whole week long to some two countries as well. So it's a real difficult life that we're leading. Having said that, I think the report that's now being discussed before you tracks South Africa's nationally determined. It's now, remember, the I used to be there. In intended nationally determined contributions. We are tabling this as part of work that you know very well about, that which we brought to the portfolio committee, by the way, before it was tabled at UNFCCC, just before Judith, was not just before the Paris Agreement, it was, yes, it was before the Paris Agreement. At the time when the deadline of all INDCs had to come in, we brought that work to the portfolio committee. It was the then portfolio committee, and they then discussed it, and we adopted it. Similarly, this report also has several other departments. I think it's about four key, if not three, core departments that are participants in this, which is energy, transport, and what? Trade and industry in terms of other related matters that are, yes, agriculture as well. What I want to say also, Chair, is that much as we would be tabling this report here today, we should be aware that the latest withdrawal of the Americans, President Donald Trump, will certainly create a situation we expect where parties may want to start giving us pressure of high ambition on this particular matter. We need to be alive to that situation. And also remember at all times that this NDC is a product of consultation in South Africa with industry, because we didn't really think that it is going to be helpful to over pressure our industry, because our country is, the companies need to survive as well on a sustainable development basis, as you know. And remember that our trajectory of a reduction of carbon emission does take that into cognizance, that we will do our best within the capacity that South Africa can. And that's why it has capabilities included in our NDC as well. So when that moment comes of being pressurized, we need to be alive that we actually would be asked to take pressure and to take over from what other people are not doing. And a developed country like America, if it's not coming on board, it's not only money that we are counting here, by the way, it's their own commitments as well, their own NDC, which means that it will be minus, the world will be minus that NDC, Judy, minus that NDC, and therefore it could be expected that some of us are asked for it, fill in the gap, which is going to be extremely problematic, we must say, because to fill in a gap of a developed country with emissions they continue to emit anyway, because they are not part of this agreement, and we are bound, it's going to be very, very unfair. Remember, this is a universal agreement, so that could that moment could come. But I think today we are ready to present that part with this understanding, Chair. There's a group called the High Ambition Coalition, which we have deliberately not joined, because we don't quite know yet what lies behind this High Ambition Coalition. They say that they are trying to work with private sector. Yes, we do work with private sector as well, to get money elsewhere, but we do think that even as they get money, if they want to get money from private sector to do joint developments and partnerships, we are doing the same, but it shouldn't be in isolation from funds like the Green Climate Fund, because there could be a tendency developed that there's now reliance on partnerships instead of people getting on with their obligations, which of money that they should be popping in. So the alignment should always be there, and nobody should be in the corner to do something that's called a high ambition coalition. It must be on the table, it must be negotiated, we do believe. So that is part of what the whole world agrees to. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you very much, Minister. I guess Judy will give us the presentation. Over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, and if I may just introduce Chloe Ramaru, who is the Chief Director responsible for adaptation. Debra Ramalope, who is the Chief Director responsible for emission reduction and mitigation, greenhouse gas reduction, and Dr. Thuli Khumalo, who will deal with the air quality management matters. And then we have the compliance and enforcement team who will come towards the end of the session. So I'll do the presentation on tracking South Africa's nationally determined contributions. Honourable members will be familiar from a previous presentation that the Paris Agreement requires South Africa to submit a nationally determined contribution every 5 years. We, as Minister has indicated, we submitted an intended nationally determined contribution in 2015. And it applies to the period post-2020, so the commitments are set out for the period post-2020 and deal with adaptation, greenhouse gas emission reduction, and means of implementation. We also, to achieve those commitments, we need to develop and scale up policies and measures to implement our commitments and to report on progress with these policies and measures. We need to account for our nationally determined contribution. We need to submit biennial reports to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change on national circumstances, emissions, adaptation, and all other elements of South Africa's climate change response. We need to submit regular communications on our adaptation efforts, and we are encouraged to develop a long-term low-carbon development strategy. Honourable Members, I'm going to go briefly through the governance framework for adaptation and transitioning to climate resilience, followed by the governance framework for emission reduction and transitioning to lower carbon economy, and then go into the tracking in more detail. So the governance framework for adaptation, adapting to the impacts of climate change and transitioning to climate resilience, really includes development of a national adaptation strategy and its operationalization, bringing climate change response into national, subnational and sector policy frameworks, developing an early warning vulnerability and adaptation monitoring system for key climate vulnerable sectors and geographic areas, development of a vulnerability assessment and adaptation needs framework by 2020, communication of past investments in adaptation, for education and awareness purposes, as well as for international recognition, and then building the necessary institutional capacity for climate change response. And I think to say that the national adaptation strategy is well underway. We have reported that to honourable members in the past, and the national framework on climate services is being finalised. The National Framework on Climate Services is a process that is guided broadly by the World Meteorological Organization, and what it does is to enable coordinated climate change response data and information, and making sure that climate change response data and information is, meets its target audience, or those that need the data and information. We've undertaken risk and vulnerability assessments and developed provincial response plans for 9 provinces. This has been led by the provincial departments. The capacity support program has been rolled out to municipalities through the Let's Respond Toolkit, and sector departments have developed their sector adaptation plans, and bringing climate change response into their planning frameworks. In terms of the governance framework for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, the commitment in our nationally determined contribution is that greenhouse gas emissions will peak by 2025, plateau between 2025 and 2035, and decline in 2035. So it's expressed as a trajectory range of between 398 to 614 megatons CO2 equivalent. And this is part of the commitment that was consulted very broadly with South Africans. Pre-2020 implementation really establishes the foundation for meeting these post-2020 commitments. And the work that is already underway is phase one of the emission reduction system, which takes place between 2016 and 2020. Which includes a mitigation potential analysis, setting of carbon budgets, setting mitigation plans by those companies with carbon budgets, a greenhouse gas reporting system, and then development of phase two of the emission reduction system, which will be implemented between 2021 and 2025. So this this is an indication of the framework and the sequencing for phase two. And there you can see that the mitigation potential analysis will be done, completed by 2018, that's next year. The carbon budgets and the sector emission targets are for those sectors, as Minister has indicated, energy, industry, agriculture, transport. Those will be set in 2018. There'll be a call for mitigation plans between 2018-19. Annual reporting takes place between 2021 and 2025. And then we do assessment of compliance at the end of the cycle in 2026. So this cycle is what is taking place currently for the 2016 to 2020 period. And at the same time, there's a detailed consultation process underway to set the methodology, build in lessons learned from phase one, and initiate phase two. In terms of tracking progress in South Africa's transition to a lower carbon and climate resilient economy, we have a national climate change response monitoring and evaluation system, which really consists of a tool that provides complete information on the state of climate change and the inclusive of scenarios and impacts, a tool for reporting of greenhouse gas emissions by industry, a tool for compilation of the greenhouse gas inventory, the monitoring, reporting, and verification guidelines for reporting emission reductions from mitigation programs, a greenhouse gas reporting improvement program, and a tool for tracking desired adaptation outcomes. In terms of reporting on progress on implementation, so far we've compiled and produced 5 greenhouse gas inventory reports. The current one, 2000 to 2012, is being finalized, inclusive of stakeholder consultation. Unfortunately, the time period for consolidating data, for receiving data from industry, processing that data, and compiling the inventory means that our inventory is usually about 3 years behind the current date. So the 2000 to 2012 inventory has yet to be finally gazetted. At the same time, we are working on the 2000 to 2015 greenhouse gas inventory. So it's a cyclical process. As we conclude the last inventory, we initiate the reporting process for the next inventory. We are finalizing South Africa's second biennial update report for submission by the end of this year. That's also a report required by the United Nations Framework Convention. And the biennial update report essentially is a report on the impact and outcomes of South Africa's strategic greenhouse gas reduction initiative. We are also finalizing our third national communication, and that's the national communication that consolidates the state of the impacts of climate change in South Africa and the responses. We're finalizing South Africa's second climate change annual report, and that's a consolidation of all of the reporting programs. So that includes the reports that we have on greenhouse gas reduction, the reports that we have on adaptation, the reports that we have on the international process into a single climate change annual report. The first such climate change annual report was published last year, and I think members received copies of it, and the second annual report will be published by the end of this year. So here's some examples of the data that is coming out of the combination of the greenhouse gas inventory, the biennial update report, and consolidated into the annual report. This, I must just say, honourable members, is from the 2000 to 2012 inventory, which is the inventory that is still in the final stages of being quality controlled. There's quite a stringent process of quality controlling these inventories. As you can imagine, we have to quality control the data that is received, quality control the putting together of the inventory, doing the calculations, and quality control the final inventory. So in terms of the tracking the transition to a lower carbon economy, the energy sector, not surprisingly, remains the single largest contributor to the country's total greenhouse gas emissions, 81.7% in 2012. The renewable energy contribution to the national energy mix increased significantly from 2000 to 2012. However, the overall carbon intensity of the national energy system remained fairly constant. And there, to the left, you can see the proportional contributions of energy, industry, agriculture, forestry, land use, and waste to the total greenhouse gas emissions of the country. And on the right, you can see that it's basically a graph that shows the emissions in relation to our GDP, our GDP in relation to our energy supply, and the emissions in relation to our energy supply. Essentially that so far the overall carbon intensity of the national energy system remains constant, but over time we expect a decoupling of GDP from emissions as we transition to a lower carbon economy.
So the energy sector, if you can just unpack that one. Is it which industries are in the energy sector?
That's energy generation. So
yeah,
from
Eskom.
So it will be
Sasol.
It's electricity and liquid fuels.
Sasol and Eskom.
Yeah, Sasol and Eskom. And petrochemicals, yeah.
Okay.
In terms of the decoupling of emissions from economic growth over 2000 and 2012. What we can see is significant mitigation. Emission reductions estimated at 779 megatons. And the biggest contribution of that is energy efficiency measures, which are responsible for between 82 and 85% of reductions. Essentially that's across all sectors. But in particular within the industry sector, looking at the range of different energy efficiency measures that industry is taking. To look at our greenhouse gas inventory in relation to our peak, plateau, and decline trajectory range, that graph shows you the trajectory range. That is the range between 398 and 614 megatons. And you can see the plateau area there between 2025 and 2030 and 2035, so between 2025 and 2035. And the yellow line is the greenhouse gas inventory. We have been on the outer edge of our trajectory range, but you can see that in accordance with this inventory, the yellow line is starting to dip down below the 614, which is the outer edge. So it falls essentially well within the peak, plateau, and decline target trajectory range. So here's the summary, that South Africa's greenhouse gas inventory trajectory compared to the CPD trajectory and the mitigation NDC target of the country. By 2012, there was an implied carbon budget of 96 megatons between the greenhouse gas inventory levels and the upper limit of the emission trajectory range. So there's 96 that can be observed as the space within which to maneuver. This means that between 2012 and 2025, the country's emissions should not grow faster than 7.4 megatons per year on average. And at the moment, with our economic growth we do not expect our emissions growth rate above 7.4 megatons. So and in addition to that, South Africa is implementing a range of energy efficiency measures, renewable energy measures. So we are likely to be within the upper range of our greenhouse gas trajectory range, but remember that is the top range. We need to be aiming for the middle of that range and preferably below the middle of that range. In terms of tracking our adaptation efforts, a set of desired adaptation outcomes have been developed. And this is really the tool for monitoring the extent to which South Africa's major indicators of climate change impact are being positively or negatively affected. A big one here is water and the resilience of our water supply, food security, and I think this is an area that we could bring more detail to the honourable members. A set of high-level indicators have been proposed under each of the desired adaptation objectives. Consultations with key stakeholders are underway to facilitate the buy-in and ownership of these desired adaptation objectives. These are part of the national adaptation strategy, so we have a set of objectives that are set in the national adaptation strategy. And essentially what we are looking towards is making sure that there's synergies between the strategic priorities in the national adaptation strategy, our adaptation goals in the NDC, the SDGs, climate action targets and indicators, and the UNCCD, the Combating Desertification Objectives, Expected Impacts and Indicators. And honourable members, this is quite critical that we make sure that our efforts to implement the SDGs, our efforts to implement the commitments we set in our nationally determined contribution under the UNFCCC, and our efforts under the UN Convention on Combating Desertification are aligned, and that we are not, there's no duplication, and there's no unintended consequences of one set of implementation programs on the other. The annual report I've already spoken to. In the second annual report, we're including the implications of the Paris Agreement on South Africa, determining the effectiveness of adaptation actions, the quantification of the impact of mitigation projects, an analysis of the recent drought in South Africa, in particular from the El Nino effect, but also exacerbated by increasing warming, increasing global air temperatures and also sea temperatures associated with climate change, and progress in implementing the flagship program. In terms of national action and national implementation, there's a set of strategic programs that are led by sector departments, other national departments, some of which the department is either supporting or collaborating or cooperating with the sector departments. But these are the key departments or the key programs that we are relying on over the next 20 years to reduce our emissions. So there's the National Energy Efficiency Strategy, which is led by the Department of Energy, which sets the quantifiable targets for the major demand sectors as well as the supply sectors, and that the National Energy Efficiency Strategy is a key part of South Africa's reduction of emissions. The Integrated Resource Plan, that's the resource plan that also is led by the Department of Energy, which sets our energy mix. In the updated version of the Integrated Resource Plan is currently being negotiated through the Department of Energy, and it really sets out the preferred generation technologies for our energy mix. It includes the renewable energy program, which honourable members are very familiar with. There's the South Africa Centre for Carbon Capture and Storage, which is looking at clean technology applications for carbon capture and storage. There's the DTI incentive schemes, which drives growth, foreign direct investment, and promotes competitiveness in the manufacturing sector, in line with the IPAP and the industrial plans, effectively, the industry plans, action plan. There's a series of financial incentives to promote the use of lower carbon technologies. There's the public transport strategy, focusing on accelerated modal upgrading and integrated rapid public transport. There's the biofuels industrial strategy. And from a adaptation perspective, there is the Water Conservation and Demand Management Program, Department of Water and Sanitation, which is a suite of programs including, there's a suite of programs, the examples there are just part of them. There's the Agriculture Food System and Food Security Flagship, led by the Department of Agriculture, as well as the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, which is implementing integrated climate smart agriculture, and looking at climate smart agriculture credit lines, insurance and risk reduction management. In terms of the flagship programs, low carbon flagship programs, there's the waste management flagship program, which is about diversion of solid waste from landfill and alternative waste treatment. biogas and combined heat power generation from wastewater. There's the energy efficiency and demand management flagship program led by Energy and Public Works around energy efficiency in our public buildings. There's the renewable energy flagship program led by Department of Energy. Honourable members are familiar with this. And there's the low carbon climate resilient built environment communities and human settlements program led by the Department of Human Settlements and Public Works, really focusing on residential greening and certification program and public sector greening. Honourable members, the mitigation potential analysis, we presented the first version to Parliament not last year but in 2015, and that mitigation potential analysis will be updated. We are working with the Department of Science and Technology as guided by Minister to do an assessment of the extent to which there is uptake of the low carbon technologies that are set out in the mitigation potential. There was a total number of 172 mitigation technologies, of which we lifted out the 20 most low-hanging fruits, those mitigation technologies that are the lower cost mitigation technologies with the higher emission reduction potential. And we're working with DST on a mitigation technology plan to make sure that the necessary incentives are in place to bring or to scale up those mitigation technologies and make sure that they are built into our economy. Thank you, Honourable Members, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much, Julie. Can we get, so we will then engage on this one and then from there we go to the quality issues. Members, any questions from the members? Honorable Edward, you want to say something? Members are happy with the presentation. Okay, Honorable Edward and Honorable Taden.
Thank you, Jay. I've got two themes I'll ask. With regards to the bigger polluters, how are we doing with regards to this specific to the standards, to the minimum emission standards. As far as I know, they're still not compliant. But if I go look at your trajectories, if you go look at, you know, if you go and you see, okay, 50 years or 70 years from now, it's just gonna get worse. So if we don't force them to comply, we're gonna literally be screwed. So are we still granting them postponements, and if so, why? Surely we should, I don't know, surely we can come down harder on them, can't we? Should we? Shouldn't we? What is the department doing and planning on forcing them to comply? And also, I mean, honestly, we're only asking them to comply with our minimum emission standard. It's like we're asking them to go with the health organization standards, etc. So, in other words, I kind of want to know what will the department do to those not complying, and will you still give them postponements? And then also when it comes to monitoring.
You're on the next presentation.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll do this one. Thank you.
Okay. Honorable Pedin.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just have a simple question here. The tracking progress, I'd like the department to tell me who actually drives the process of tracking. You know, we were told later on in the presentation who the lead departments are and who's responsible, but who drives the tracking? Who drives the tools for the tracking process?
Okay. Honorable Nyambi. Then Honorable Khadele.
Thank you, Chair. Can I start by welcoming the presentation from Judy? Chairperson, I've heard Judy talking about, the minister talking about Donald Trump pulling out from this agreement. Then I want to know that, can the United States pull out almost immediately out of the Paris Agreement, or can that only occur after a certain period of time? So if it is going to happen in that case, what is the duration for the U.S. to pull out of the Paris deal? Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Khadim.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I don't know whether it was clarified in all my absence. I would like to know, do we have an updated greenhouse inventory report? Because I see you are using 2012, where we are projecting that there will be 90 megaton CO2 equivalent of greenhouse gas. Actually, what I want to know, plus, according to your prediction, you were looking at the economy growing between 0.4% per year, and we were thinking that it won't grow more than 1.5%. But looking at the current situation where we have a sluggish economic growth, does that mean that we won't be seeing the emissions average growth not reaching more than 7.4 megaton CO2 equivalent in the future? Is that still going to be the same implication? Because maybe there will be a radical economic growth after this sluggish economic growth as we are facing currently. That won't affect the average growth of the emissions in the country. Have you factored that? Because I would be more interested if you were looking at the current greenhouse gas inventory report. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable McQuarrie.
Thank you, Chairperson. Perhaps firstly, just to thank you for your comments earlier and the support you gave to the difficulties. But just two questions, perhaps. It is said that the cycle for the capturing of information on the inventory, it's 3 years behind all the time. What was going to be the reasonable time frame? We have that, but you mentioned that it's 3 years behind the schedule. But the second question is just to understand what, in terms of the, or whether the department has ascertained in terms of the reduction of these emissions, how much we're going to do ourselves on our own as a country without assistance by either foreign capital or other countries in terms of funding, or what is it that we can do on our own, or what is it that we'll need to do with the help of funding from elsewhere? Thanks.
Okay, thank you. For myself, I just want to, okay, on the decision by the US, I wonder what is it that we can do, Honorable Minister. I know that Trump has signaled his intention to withdraw. The process will take about 12 months, but it's not going to be immediate. So they will still be an opportunity to probably engage with the administration, the Trump administration. Probably it might be out of not understanding precisely the Paris Agreement, because it calls for nationally determined contributions. So the country is nationally determined by the countries. It's not as as hard and fast like the first agreement where the US was not a part of Kyoto Protocol, which was more mandatory. This one is a bit more flexible, where countries can even negotiate, of course, within the overall framework of the agreement. So I don't know what the discussions are, but I believe that the administration could still be engaged during the period which is allowed for a country to withdraw, because it's not going to be immediate. But what is encouraging as well is that most of the states have actually sort of domesticated the agreement. Some of the states, some of the local government institutions there have embraced the Paris Agreement, and they are working towards its fulfillment. But of course, without a nationally determined kind of an approach, it may be difficult for those states on their own. But even when the U.S. administration was announcing their decision, most of the states came out in support of the Paris Agreement, and to say that this thing that Trump is doing is ill-informed, ill-advised, it's not in the interest of the human population around the world. So there are still voices, but I don't know what are the possibilities of further engaging with the administration on that one. But if those possibilities are there, we'll encourage that they must be pursued. In terms of this, our peak plateau decline trajectory, is it possible to quantify this? To say what is our current emissions? What is our target in terms of the peak scenario? What is our targets in terms of the deadline, the plateau and the deadline? And what are the contributing industries? And what is the target for each of the industries that we are looking at? Are we able to simplify this to a point where it can be easy to track down? I know it's quite a complex issue of the emissions, but it's possible for us to simplify it in such a way that we can be able to follow up. To say currently these are the range, and these are the contributing industries, and these are our targets. And up until from now to 2020 or 2025, because some of the actions that needs to be taken must be done now. We might be looking at a 5-year range, but only to find that at the time when we are expecting the peak and the plateau, nothing happens because we did not take action now. So are we able to do that? that to the slide on governance that talks to, it talks about 398 to 614, but I just want to understand if we can break that one down. My second point is on the dominance of the energy sector to the greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, this has got a history of South Africa's evolution of our economy and its development, which is largely carbon-based, the energy. Are we able to break it down to the different industries' contribution? Because it will also help us set targets for those industries. But in the 81% that 81.7% as in 2012, I take it that you will also respond to the question of Honorable Khadebe that what is the situation currently. Now in the 81.7%, are we able to break it down to say this industry contributes so much and this one contributes so much and this one contributes so much? And in line with our strategy, these are the reductions in terms of each industry that we need to track over a period of time so that by 2020, 2025, this industry would have contributed so much to the reduction. And then you can break it down to a lower level. Are you able to do that? That's my question. And the climate, the report on climate change, unfortunately I missed the second one, the first one. Maybe it was before my time, before I came to the committee. When are you going to finalize the second report? This annual report that we are intending to produce annually. And my last question is on the actions, national actions. Can you get a sense of the contribution of this climate funding that we are receiving? And what are the programs there and what impact are they having on this, our mitigation, adaptation and mitigation strategies? I hope you got my questions. Okay, over to you. Oh, I didn't see you, Honorable Kicker. You have been co-opted by the executive. Yeah, I see. She's occupying the deputy minister's position. Oh, okay. No, she has been co-opted into the executive. It's fine. All right. Minister, you will start, Judy.
Thanks, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'll start and then Minister can make sure that I'm on track. So I think there were a set of questions around the issue of the withdrawal of the USA from the agreement. I think Minister may want to come in on that matter, but just to say that what the Paris Agreement allows for is as long as the US does not withdraw from the UNFCCC, It is a three-year process for them to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. So that essentially means that that they would be fully withdrawn by November 2020, is our understanding. And certainly, and I think Minister will come in here, but certainly every means at our disposal at political level to influence that decision is underway. I think what also needs to be said, however, is that the USA, as with South Africa, has a nationally determined contribution and a commitment, and a number of programs that, similar to South Africa, we have a set of strategic programs to meet our NDC. The USA has a set of strategic programs to meet their commitment in their NDC. And with the current presidency, there is an undermining of those programs, with the potential that, in fact, the very high potential that the USA would not meet their commitment, which is the reason that there is this pressure, because the commitment in the Paris Agreement is to a world in which temperature increase is well below 2 degrees. That requires a multilateral effort across the board. It requires all countries to play their fair share and to do their part. And without the USA, it is really undermining the multilateral effort. There were a set of questions. I think the questions around the minimum emission standards, Dr. Kamala will answer in her next presentation. That's the minimum emission standards relating to particulate matter, SOx, NOx, and other pollutants, the criteria pollutants. There were a set of questions around the tracking and how does the tracking system work, who drives the tracking system, and what is reasonable in terms of the greenhouse gas inventory in relation to the number of years behind the current date within which we are able to report. So the tracking system is driven by the Department of Environmental Affairs, together with all the relevant data providers, of which there are many. We cannot do our job of driving the tracking system without receiving the data from, for example, the South African Weather Services. We need data from industry. We need data from the different sector departments that are either affected by climate change or that must contribute and play a role in reducing greenhouse gases. So the Department of Environment is responsible for pulling the data together, and we are working on a web-based system. At the moment, we have different components of that web-based system. The greenhouse gas inventory, for example, was previously, until the gazetting of the greenhouse gas reporting regulations, was done on an informal basis. So we had a memorandum of understanding with industries that were providing greenhouse gas data, and the fact that we now have greenhouse gas reporting regulations means that we have improved the system by requiring mandatory reporting. We also have a greenhouse gas inventory improvement system, and that system is about trying to move us from 3 years, a difference between the date of our greenhouse gas report coming out for the period 2012 in comparison with where we are, which is a three-year period down, so that we reduce that time frame, we reduce that lag. 3 years is pretty much the standard for a developing country. 3 to 4 years is the standard internationally for a developing country to take that period of time to receive the data, clean the data, consolidate the data, and produce the greenhouse gas inventory. So we are within the norm in terms of that period of time, but we are working to reduce the lag. And the reason it's important to reduce the lag is, as Honourable Chair has said, we need the most recent data, the most recent information as soon as possible to be able to inform us as to the extent to which we are reducing our emissions overall or not. On the matter of 0.4% and the growth,
there's 3 years average time to get data for the emissions.
It's a combination, Honourable Chair, of receiving the data, compiling the data, analysing the data, pulling together the greenhouse gas inventory, doing the quality control, because the United Nations Framework Convention has very specific quality control requirements, including external review, then sending it out for stakeholder comment, because we gazette it for public comment to ensure that we have accommodated any additional data or information, and then finally taking it through cabinet, and then finally gazetting it as an inventory. It's a long and extensive process. Just the process of receiving the data it's a 6 month to 1 year period to receive the data. So we need to shorten each of those steps in order to make sure that our inventory, which is it starts from 2000, it moves to 2000, and the last one that is gazetted, the final one, was 2000 to 2010. Now we're busy finalizing 2000 to 2012. In the meantime, we have already initiated 2000 to 2015. So we're busy receiving the data for the 2000 to 2015.
So the figures we have is that 2012.
So
they have the recent figures.
2012 is still being finalized. It's still on the process of independent review and cabinet, and then it will be gazetted. It has gone out for public comment, and we've accommodated all the comments from the public already.
Okay, but we're in 2017.
Yeah, so it's a 3 to 4 year period. Yeah.
Very good. Hey, that's quite a long period.
That's what I've just said. Yeah.
Okay, we'll come back to this because it then means that if we track the reduction, we won't be able to track. We'll track the reduction over a period of more than 5 years.
So, Honourable Chair, the components of reducing South Africa's emissions. If I can just take you back to the slide, where on a cycle we do the mitigation potential analysis. So, in phase one. We concluded that mitigation potential analysis in 2018. We set the carbon budgets, so we concluded that setting of carbon budgets in 2016. The mitigation plans are then are currently being concluded. The annual reporting is the annual reporting that at the moment we are working on that greenhouse gas inventory, as well as the adaptation reporting, and then we do the assessment of compliance. So it's a series of different elements in the reporting process. We can't use only a greenhouse gas inventory. We have to use each of those, and each of those are set out in a 5-year cycle. And the inventory, the 2000 to 2012 inventory, yes, it's 3 to 4 years behind. That said, we are also able to do the work that looks ahead. So we're doing a piece of work currently which is focusing on strategic policies and measures. The strategic policies and measures that are implemented currently and are envisaged for the next 5 years, those strategic policies and measures, we quantify those strategic policies and measures, and we have an understanding of the extent to which those policies and measures are able to keep our emissions within the greenhouse gas trajectory range. So it's a combination of forward-looking tools and instruments and backward-looking. The inventory is the backward-looking one. The mitigation potential analysis, the assessment of policies and measures and quantification and the setting of the carbon budget are the forward-looking.
Okay, proceed, but it's quite a bit disconcerting for me. Of course, I'm saying this without having the benefit of the capacity that we have to do this thing. That it takes us at least 5 years to have a picture of the greenhouse gas emissions in the country.
Honourable, if I can just clarify that it's...
Shouldn't it be done annually or something so that... how do we get a picture of the emissions that are there and how we track them and how we make sure that we set targets and follow up on the targets? It's not something that must happen as soon as possible. I mean, if we wait for... 2017, we're waiting for the 2012 one for the country to have an idea of what are the current emissions, greenhouse gas emissions level.
So, Honourable Chair, there are...
Maybe I should ask a question conversely. How do we get data from the industry of the emissions? How do we get data of the emissions?
I think the other challenge is that we never had regulations. Our regulations have just been promulgated to make it mandatory for companies to submit greenhouse gases. Previously, it was more of a gentleman's agreement, a high-level agreement with BUSA to get greenhouse gases from different companies. And now going forward, it will be mandatory for companies to do that. So what we're looking at, seeing that the regulations were only promulgated in the middle of the year, they should have started reporting basically or recording information or data from the beginning of the calendar year up to December, and around April, May, then they submit that information to the department, and the department still needs to verify the data before we can compile the GHG inventory. So we're working towards squeezing that overall period. If you look at collection of data from companies, verification, compiling the GHG inventory, peer review, stakeholder consultation, it can roughly go just over 2 years. That's something that we need to look at in terms of shortening that period, because it also has to come to cabinet before we publish for stakeholder consultations and all that.
Can I just come in, Chair? You're raising important matters. But just to say that this is actually the second report that we are going to be submitting, meaning that this system has actually started now around 2010-2012 for that particular cycle, with the regulatory framework and so forth. And I'm saying here, trying to indicate to this August House that what we are really doing here and reporting here is not the ultimate end of how things will go, but it's a build-up towards a process of leading up to annual data collation, even if our report at UNFCCC is required by ENIAC. So for us to then get to build up this system, which we are building, by the way, I'm saying the question you're asking is important because it does say, where are we going? Where are we are going is where we are going to be having this information on an annual basis. And therefore, the system is envisaged that as we move on, probably in the next reporting cycle, would be much, much, much better with no 3 year lag behind. I asked who are you? Deborah, sorry. They look alike, it's true.
I don't see
it. I'm colorblind, so. So I asked Deborah to look up for us which of the developing countries are actually having this system already overall. I bet you we are going to be one of the leading ones when we give you this, because this is actually the beginning of the process. We are moving towards bettering the system and getting the accurate information. And we must also be glad that the UNFCCC is insisting on getting qualitative reporting so that you don't just collect anything and send batch to the UNFCCC. It's going to be verified, it's going to be quality by the time it goes there. So even at the time when we get our systems right and reduced, it will mean also that it's quality information that we have. Remember, the actual NDCs are implementable post 2020. But the reporting happens now even on voluntary basis as we are here, because the implementation of the actual NDC is going to happen around that time as compulsory. So Chair, I think it should be understood in that way. And perhaps we should also give you the list of those who are still building their systems. It will be developed countries for now. Maybe not even all of them, by the way.
You want to make a quick follow-up on this one? I was taking advantage of the fact that I'm sharing to interject on that issue, but I can allow you to.
Actually, Chair, I just want to get more clarity, because I remember Dr. Khumalo mentioned some time ago that he will be migrating to a live reporting to SACIS of the emission. I just want to know how far is that.
Yeah, but that's the other emissions.
That is in relation to the same question.
The greenhouse gas?
Yeah.
No, my understanding is that these are the other emissions. You want to comment on that?
Honourable Chair, I think we can talk to the live reporting when Thuli does the...
No, the question is just for Thuli to confirm whether you got the same.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Is the live reporting is not for emissions, even the criteria pollutants, it's for the state of air.
Okay. Yeah, that was my understanding. But proceed, Thuli, with the rest of the questions.
I think that, there was a question around how much action are we able to take as a country with our own support or without support? Honourable members, we have, every time we do a biennial update report, which is done every 2 years, we quantify and summarize the donor funding that has been received and the outcome and product achieved with that donor funding. So we have a tracking, a means of tracking the receipt of the receiving of donor funding and the extent to which that is used and achieves certain outcomes. The question on how much are we able to do without support is a question that is not an easy question to answer. As a country, we are we're part of the multilateral environment in which donor funding at the moment is less available to South Africa and is reducing. And we have to do as much, we have to take action ourselves. We are receiving extensive support at this stage from a number of different countries, and that support is going into not only our flagship programs and our tracking systems and putting our planning and governance systems in place, but we are also, as a country, applying for funding from the Green Climate Fund. So the work that will be done around understanding and quantifying the greenhouse gas reduction outcomes of our policies and measures, our current strategic policies and measures, will give us a sense of the extent to which we are able to achieve our commitment, our greenhouse gas commitment, and the extent to which we require support going forward. The can we break our emissions down? Can we break the 81.7% of energy emissions down? Yes, we can, because we receive the data from the relevant companies that are reporting. So yes, we can do that breakdown. Whether we can break it down to actual facility level at this stage, we're not able to do that at this stage, but in time we will be able to do that.
But industries, can't you?
Yeah, we because industries are reporting, so we have a good idea of where the emissions are coming from. And over time, that as we improve our system, we will have a much better idea over time. The final point question.
Can you give us that, if you are able to do that, can you just send it to us, that information, to supplement your presentation?
Yeah.
Okay.
When is the second annual report due? It's due by the end of this year, 2017.
The right answer, Chair, is when is it not due? It's submitted. That is ready, it's been finalized. It's this one I've seen, Chair.
So Minister, there's two. There's the biennial update report that
and
goes to the UNFCCC, and then there's South Africa's annual report, which pulls together the biennial update report, the greenhouse gas inventory, our reports, our various reports to the UNFCCC.
Okay. So it's possible to have that before the end of the year. Okay. Are you able to come present to us once it's ready and it has gone through all the proper reporting? I think we'd like to have a presentation on that one. Once it's approved, submitted, approved, and you publish, can you please just come and present to us?
Honourable Chair, certainly once it's approved and it's been through all the approval processes, it's been through Cabinet, we certainly will. We presented last year the first annual report.
Okay. All right, and then the other questions about the funding, climate financing and the impact. The minister going to answer that one.
The finance people, how much of it is aggregated, Judy? how much of the billions of US dollars is South Africa? Just in short, we were asked to answer this question internationally. I'm on record loudly, but I don't know how to deal with it. This answer that I'm about to give. We didn't think that it was going to be helpful to give those people out there this answer.
What I was asking, it was on the actions. I just wanted to find out the impact of the funding that you get from the other funding agencies, as well as from Treasury. There is some funding that comes from Treasury on green. I can't remember all the funding. So, because you have not included them in the on the national actions, to say, the flagship programs, the impact, and all of those. Not necessarily the amount. I'm sure we'll get to the amount at some stage.
So, Honourable Chair, we can give you that in detail from the biennial update report of last year, and the current biennial update report is currently going through Cabinet. So as soon as that has gone through Cabinet, we would have the updated version. That does a breakdown of all of the finance received and the outcome per program. But I can do a break. I can get this.
No, it's fine.
I can get the information to you from the last biennial update report.
I just need
to find another presentation.
I just thought that you needed to give us some sense of what are those interventions arising from the funding on the actions, national actions. But we'll get that report. It's fine, Minister. Or was there any other question that needed to be answered?
Chair,
let's wait for the minister and then we'll check whether are the questions that have not been responded to.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. We, as Judy has reported, that the process of actual real disengagement, in our understanding, I think it's even legally so, correct, will actually only happen in 3 years down the line. What we probably would have to just ascertain, though, is whether if the U.S. does not come on board with their contribution. Remember, there are two kinds of contributions that they made, a commitment. It's one related to their own actions, but also the one related to their support to developing nations, which is where they have to, they take, undertook, I think it's about $3 billion or $5 billion US dollars. There's that amount, somewhere between those two. I can't remember the exact figure. If they choose not to come on board now, because as we hear, President Donald Trump's withdrawal, signal to withdraw, is mainly also based on the fact that, not on the fact, on the allegation that the U.S. has been shortchanged, and them being inward-looking as they are, what they may do is to vote with their feet also in relation to the money. Now, if they do that, it will mean that some of the programs are shortchanged. So that's one thing that I think we need to keep in our minds as well. And having said that, we are doing our level best to engage. And it's not only South Africa that engages. We're also being encouraged, by the way, by some of the people who are very sympathetic to the process and to the commitment internally in the U.S. themselves to say that they would like the U.S. to also continue. It's not only in states, but also nationally. Unfortunately, some of them are no longer some of those who are in power. So the decision has to be made. Lobbying would have to continue to happen, which we are doing. We have recently had discussions with some of the developed countries, which we know would have been meeting at the meeting of the G8. And in that meeting, we asked also continuously asking that they raise this matter. Even when we were at the Petersburg Dialogue recently, we asked and lobbied other countries to also do the same. So the lobbying and the discussion encouraging the U.S. is continuing. What I thought that perhaps we could also do, Chair, is that at the level of the parliamentarians, maybe you could also do the same, engagement of the senators out there as parliament itself, and maybe not collectively and formally, but informally. It is a very important thing to do, and of course we also see that there are recently, I think last week, we learned of 21 young people who have actually taken the matter to court. We don't know how that court will go. Hopefully, if it goes well for our side, it would be much better for the whole world. It's not only that, there are several other attempts. Our leadership of the country has also had discussion already at that level, I mean at the highest level, as we are engaging at ministerial level as well as at technical level. Julie and them, when they were in Bonn recently, they also did the same, continued to speak to the U.S. The unfortunate thing is that the people who are at negotiations level, Julie, at the level of negotiations, are the same team members who have actually negotiated this agreement. So they themselves are very frustrated. Our counterpart as what would be the state secretary or the special envoy has not yet arrived, the new one. It used to be Mr. Todd Sten and John Kerry. They have both gone, so we are waiting also to have at ministerial level from the U.S. itself, the new leader coming to a meeting. Hopefully at the pre-COP that person will be there, but we are going to continue to push and push hard. And really nagging the U.S. to come on board. That's, I think, the undertaking that we can make, and also a request that perhaps you continue to also engage the senators themselves, because I'm not sure how this would have to be decided. See, Mr. President, former President Obama had actually made these decisions, and not only that, but ensured that the system also has got intertwines and embodies and tangles some of the implementation programs. Already, as you say, the state has already mainstreamed some of these projects. It might take a while, it may be difficult to even reverse some of them, especially if the states are implementing already some of them. But what worries us is the fact that at a national level, there might be those two areas of the real impact on their emissions, but the real impact also on money. What comes out clearly is that President Trump is seemingly not happy with the issue of the fossil fuel, and he voices out that their industry would be much more, I think it's much more in favor of those fossil fuel industries in particular continuing as is. So it's going to be a very difficult thing, even if we were ever to dream of going back to the negotiations, dream of financing and getting that passing through. I don't think it will happen. Renegotiation is just completely a no-no there. But we are continuing to lobby. I remember that during the President Bush administration, there was right at the beginning this kind of, not an announcement, but an intention to, and later on it had not succeeded. We hope that it goes that direction too, at some stage. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. I hope the minister and the team have answered the questions. Can we then move, honorable ministers requested to be released to attend the joint cabinet committee meeting. You are released, minister. I'm also going to leave at 12:30. 12 to attend another meeting. Can we get the next presentation, please, on air quality? Tuli?
Morning, Mr. Morning, Chair. Morning, Honorable Members. I'm going to present on two items, on the hybrid report and the state of the priority area. My colleague is going to cover the issues around the enforcement of the minimum emission standards in the forest area. Perhaps just to start with the legal background to indicate that the Equality Act provides for the minister to declare areas that are in non-compliance with the ambient equality standards as priority areas, and as such, the department then needs to develop an air quality management plan, which then needs to be implemented and specify the desired goals for the area to come into compliance. To date, three areas have been declared by the minister. The first one is the White Asia Triangle Parish area, which is the green one in the map. And the next one is the Highfield Parish area, which is the blue one. And the bigger one is the Waterbed Bujanala Parish area. The first two, the Highfield and the Val, were declared because they are existing non-compliances, and the Waterbed Bujanala was declared as a precautionary measure due to the development that has been planned to come to the area, and also because Botswana is at the time had plans to build three coal-powered power stations just across the border from that area. So the reasoning was to manage it before it becomes a problem like we have in the high-pressure tariff area, because the nature of the industries that were planned to come to that area took the form of what you would see in the high priority area. If you look at the two Eskom power stations that are there at the time, there was also a plan to build the transformer footer. And obviously there are a whole lot of smaller industries that come into an area and other activities if there's a large-scale development. And so the idea was to manage the state of the air before it gets out of hand, if I can say that. So as part of the declaration, we then publish a nomination to the National Newspaper organization to nominate representatives, because we developed the AQMP, which is the Airport Management Plan, in consultation with the industries that are there, the communities that are there, as well as the non-government organizations, academia as well. So it's a participatory process to participate. And then with that, we obviously have regular meetings. We have implementation task teams once the equity management plan has been established, where we look at other government departments as well to do their part in terms of bringing the air into compliance. Perhaps just to say that the interaction of air pollution in the ambient space goes beyond the mandate of one department. If we look at also the types of pollution sources, you would have petroleum industries, power generation, steel, and also the other sources around domestic burning of fuel, vehicle emissions, mining is a big contributor. So the process really has to be participatory for it to have the commitments of all the relevant stakeholders. So at the moment, we also do a number of projects in the priority areas to ensure, because I mean, that's the issues are vast. So we do health studies just to look at the profile of the health of the people, so that over time we can track if with the improvements in air quality, do we see the associated improvements in the state of health of the people. We have social pushment study, which I think I'm going to explain a bit more. And we have our different awareness projects. We set up awareness task teams because some of the pollution sources can be resolved using awareness campaigns. For example, the burning of tires. Sometimes, well, I don't know if it's ever necessary to burn a tire, but it is a pollution source that can be avoided if we have awareness programs and people understand the impact of burning some of these things. to their own lives, and as well as waste in some cases. So these are the identified communities that would sit currently in the declared heritage areas, and we have programs where we work with the communities, but mostly our contact points are usually the NGOs that exist in these areas, but we also have programs where we deal with the counselors. If I can make an example, when we're looking to find people to help us with the high-field health study, we use counselors to get local community members to get involved in the area of administration of the questionnaires, and when we consulted for the study to address air pollution in low-income segments. We also worked with counselors to identify people to come to participate to. So it's a mix of both NGOs and the local leadership in those areas. So I was talking about the task team. Perhaps one of the things that we have identified as the department is what we need to do to address the issue of domestic burning in dense low-income segments is establish a strategy, because as I said, the mandate is across different departments. So in the strategy, we are working with the Department of Energy, Human Settlements and Health, and they have different aspects for implementation so that we can then take the document back to Cabinet for approval, and then we can start with the implementation. The issue of domestic burning seems to be a persistent one over time, although the numbers of people that are burning coal are reducing over time, it's still significant because the emissions are at the breeding zone. Just to talk a bit about the social apportionment study that we are conducting in the Van Triangle Parish area, it's looking at the state of air and the commitments that we had in the air quality management plan when we did the midterm review. We found that more than 70% of the commitments have been implemented. But when you look at the state of air, you don't see that same amount of improvement, which means that probably the interaction of the pollutants in the receiving environment is different from what we see when we do the source apportionment according to the emission reports that we have. As such, we decided to do a source apportionment study, which has been funded by both the industries that sit in the area and the department has also contributed to that. The purpose of the study is to identify where the pollution is coming from the receptor side. So there's modeling that goes with it that takes the receptor to say, so it will show how much of the pollution, for example, if I take particulate matter, it will show what the component of the particulate matter that is generated through combustion, and the elemental composition of that will tell you which of the sources that particulate matter comes from. So it's a first step towards identifying the major sources, so you can do that 80-20 principle, target the biggest contributors first, and then you can address the problem. But also the limitations of science is that the study will say this fraction is coming from combustion of coal. So all coal combustion facilities will be covered by that fraction. So it's not going to say how much of this, for example, comes from Eskom and how much exactly comes from Sasol. It will indicate the portion that comes from high temperature combustion of that coal. And I think that we need to clarify that, because we still need to then go back to the emissions inventory that we have to then look at in that case and how much of it comes from each of the facilities. So it's not a one-stop answer to all our questions, but it's a means to begin to answer those questions. And then I'm moving on to the Highveld priority area. It was declared by Minister on the 23rd of November 2007, and on May 2011 we completed the AKP and the Minister published it for public comment. I think just to explain that this process, it's a very long drawn-out process, and the reason in this area as opposed to, for example, the South Devon, is that there is a complex mixture of sources in the parish areas that has been declared by MINIST. It's not that you can resolve one source and then you resolve the problem. For example, in Devon, at the time when we had the problem, it was contributions from the refinery industry. When that was resolved, we started to see improvements in the state of air. But in these areas, industries need to Institute. Mining literacy is in all sources. Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. So I think that is that then the process of developing the emissions inventory and coming to the point where we are resolved around what the contributions of these sources are to the overall problem, with the consultation, of course, of the stakeholders that exist in this area and academia and all the aspects that we're able to pull in to the space to help us with that. So we finally published a document in 2011, and the final promulgation was in March 2012. Then what we did in midterm before the actual review and update of the effort management plan is the same as what we did in the VAL, where we looked at the implementation plan and said how much of this implementation plan has been achieved and what then is the resultant stage of play. So just at a high level, these are the goals that we have in the quality management plan of the Highveld. One of them was that organizational capacity in government was optimized and efficiently and effectively, so that there's different spheres of government would then take over their duties, as I think members would know that constitutionally, the function of air pollution sits across the different spheres of government. So each sphere of government has a role to play towards improving the state of air. So the first step for us was to improve that capacity to ensure that the municipalities have appointed dedicated individuals to this problem, and they are taking into their annual plans the implementation requirements that are sitting in the plan. We also wanted to reduce industrial emissions to achieve compliance with the standards over time, and we were going to set up the legal framework to deal with the dust fallout, which is likely a nuisance and not so much affecting human health, but it can be a really big issue in an area like the Highveld, where there's a lot of mining. I think it's the largest mining area in the country as it is right now. We were also looking to complete the strategy for low-income settlements so that we can start reducing pollution also from that low-level persistent source, although seasonal, but it's still a very significant source. So yes, the emission strategy as well, we started working on that, and it was linked obviously to the implementation plans of the other departments, for example, the Clean Fuels 2 of the Department of Energy, which looks to improve the quality of the fuel itself, because if you're burning better fuel, obviously the car will emit less, especially in terms of sulfur, which seems to be a persistent problem in South Africa. And then there's awareness and knowledge, because in a previous example, I indicated that our communities need to understand what impact some of these activities that they conduct have to the state of air, and it's an ongoing process. There's not going to be a time when we say that we have achieved enough awareness on that, and we have from time to time stakeholder engagement events where we reach the people and communicate on that. Another big contributor to the problem is biomass burning and agricultural emissions. So some of the activities, of course, I think also in Cape Town people would have seen the example of burning of vineyards, this burning in agricultural land, which contributes to the burning. But there's also a biomass burning season in Africa generally. And because of the air parcels that don't know any country or political boundary, we do get emissions in South Africa coming from the other countries up north from us. When there is burning of forests and grass and so on, we get signature from that during the autumn season, just before the planting season. So that is another source that needs to be managed. At least we can manage it locally, but I think burning of forest fires is largely an uncontrolled source, because once it starts burning, they just become runaway fires. And we also find that in our communities there's a lot of emissions coming from the burning of waste, largely because the waste is not collected in some of the areas, but also there are other awareness issues that we could take with communities, because people, I think, need to learn to use the skip bins that are provided in some of the communities. But in other communities, even though the skip bins are there, the rate of removal of the waste is quite reduced, and people end up burning the waste because the skip bins are full, which is another issue we found, especially in the valley, that has to deal with to some extent the capacity of the municipalities to conduct those functions. So when we look at where we are in terms of the implementation, we have government capacity has been improved. We have equality officers in all the municipalities that are relevant. And it is quite a pleasure, actually, from where I sit, to see the kind of interactions we have with municipal officials now, as opposed to back then, before the Pollution Prevention Act was repealed. We've got young people in the field excited and passionate about the work, and we're beginning to see results when it comes to government capacity. We still in government, I believe, have the issue of staff retention. So when we, you know, when people get up there where we want them to be, there's always some industry that can offer them a higher pay than what government can afford. But we do, to some extent, have consistency at the moment in terms of the officials that exist in those posts, and we are beginning to see some improvements in actual dedication and compliance enforcement related to the major sources. Perhaps I can talk to the issues of industrial emissions and address at the same time the point that the question around postponements, because the large industries exist in these areas. From what we see, where we are now and where we were at the time, far back in 2009 and those times, there has been a reduction in industrial emissions. And in all the sources, actually, when we look at them, the challenge is that the reductions are not as fast as we would want them to be, because I think I have said in the past, these problems were created over a 40-year period. It would be nice to resolve them in one day, but the reality is that the industries have been there for a very long time. We are beginning to see improvements, not to our satisfaction, obviously, because the state of affairs is not improving as fast as we would want it to be, because the people's health is being affected. But just to come to the point around postponements, which I think we have addressed slightly in the past, the reason we had that provision in the legislation was to allow for the transition of existing industries to come into compliance with new plant standards at a future specified date. Because all these pollutants have never been regulated before AQUA in the space. The APA only looked at particulate matter. And we can talk about APA, but the reality is that in setting up the new legislative framework, we needed to give industries time to come into compliance. And it's not for all industries, but the size of industries are not the same. And that is why there needs to be specific submissions for each of those who need a bit more time to clarify why they need time and at what point they will come into compliance, which we've spoken about in the compliance roadmaps. Perhaps today I can make an example of Eskom Medupi that's being constructed in the Limpopo province, just to indicate that the size of those plants requires that even the time to construct the plant itself takes long. And the time to construct pollution control technologies as well takes a similar amount of time. Because, for example, if you had to put an air fluidized gas desulfurization, the boiler needs to be present before you can construct that pollution control technology. And those are the things that take time to put in place so that the industry can come into compliance. Another point is some of our industries are very old. And so for some of the pollution control technologies that we need, they don't exist on the shelf. So the industries need to invest time and money to first research an appropriate technology and then test it before they can actually come into compliance. We have an example of Vanchem in the Highveld that has had to research from scratch what pollution control technology can go into that. Sasol is one example. There's no Sasol-like plant in the world. They have to, for some of their activities, is research from scratch, and the issues of space as well, because the pollution control technologies take up a lot of space in terms of size on the ground, which in some cases there isn't even allowance in the design of the plant, because it was built in the 50s and these things were not in a requirement at the time. So I'm saying this just to say that when we make considerations for this plant, there's no one-size-fits-all approach, because the reasons are different. Some of the Eskom stations are old, and are in due course to be decommissioned, and it's not a discussion for me. I think Judy has taken it up in the IPP discussions. But the reasoning is that for a plant that's going to be decommissioned in, say, 8 years' time, it's not good use of state funds to invest 2 billion rand in that plant and then decommission it. And so there are different considerations for the different plants. As a result, we've made requirements in these postponements to improve in the ambient environment, the state of air. That is why we have these offsets, which I believe the committee went to see when you visited the Highfield in Wadden. Those are looking to say, even though we are not reducing the milligrams per pollution per stack in the receiving environment, which is where the air pollution is going to, we are still reducing pollution to curb the effect of the pollution on the human health. It's a proven scientific method in other areas, but it is an additional requirement, not a substitute for compliance. I think I must explain that explicitly. Domestic burning, we find that the number of people who rely on coal for heating and cooking during the winter months, it is going down. But like as I said, not sufficiently, not at the speed that we need to resolve this problem. Hence, we are going ahead with the strategy for addressing air pollution in low-income settlements. Vehicle emissions, we have a strategy that is linked to the other departments' implementation plans. But the issues of vehicle emissions are also around driver behavior. It's a very big issue, and whether people are keeping their cars in good condition and so on, which is also a socio-economic and an awareness issue attached to that. We find that awareness and knowledge for equality management in the area is improving. Even the discussions we're having with community members and NGOs in the forums now is improving less, and people understand their own contributions to the problems that exist there. Spoken about the others. So what we have found as conclusions for the update of the APMP is that we need to align the activities to the objectives and make them measurable, more realistic. So overall objectives are saying reduction of industrial emissions equitably by 2020 need to be, you know, more streamlined and more specific around which industries to reduce by how much, according to what we want to achieve, which is a learning. We also have an inventory system for the reporting of all pollutants, which we've just been, we have now the second reporting period, and we are finding that overseas teasing problems around how people report and how we verify those reports that are reported by industry towards us then being able to understand the contribution of sources. And we still need to expand this inventory to the other sources of pollution. So far, we have industry and some mining houses that are reporting. In the Highfield, we have not initiated the source apportionment study, and we think that if we get the funds, it would also be beneficial to do the same study in this area. But suffice to say that it's a very expensive study because of the type of equipment that you need to put in place to do that analysis. The value is just over 11 million, and the value is a far much smaller area than the Highfield, so we would expect that the number of samples would double if you were to take that similar study to the Highfield. Hence, it would be not obviously double the cost because some of the instruments we now have, but it would obviously be a significant cost. And then just to talk to go to the monitoring now, which is the second point on the agenda. It is a legal requirement in terms of the Act that once the minister has set up ambient air quality standards, there needs to be monitoring and reporting for compliance towards understanding the state of air in relation to those standards. As such, there's a monitoring network that the different spheres of government have, some municipalities have, provincial, and the minister also has equality monitoring instruments for the priority areas that she has declared that are being managed by the South African Weather Services. This slide just shows the pollution standards, but of course this is what we have standards for. It's not to say these are the only pollution, these are the only pollutants that come out of that exist in the environment. So I'm not going to go one by one, but we have particulate matter, both 10 and 2.5. We have sulfur dioxide, we have NO2, we have ozone, carbon monoxide, and benzene. So in the Vile Triangle Airshed Priority Area, we have six stations. One at Deep Kloof, Kloof River, Sebokeng, Sharpeville, Three Rivers, and Zambela. And they are monitoring the pollutants that I have just reflected. They were established in 2007, as this was the first priority area to be declared by the minister. In the high field, we have five stations, MLO, Hendrina, Middleburg, and I think we have omitted the one that is Secunda. In the water bank, generally we have four, Lephalale, Makopane, Thabazimbi, and Sanadu station, which is largely a background station in its intent, but what we are measuring is that it is getting an influence of industrial pollution from the neighboring bridge area and long-range transport from other sources. And this is now the state of air in the priority areas. This is the Vala Triangle. Perhaps just to share at this point that there are other drivers for air pollution. For example, this drought years that we've been having in the country, we have observed increased particulate matter levels. Because when it is dry and it's windy, there's more entrainment of dust than when it is raining. And the effect that the rain has to clean up the atmosphere is not there when we have long drought periods. Unfortunately, these things affect the state of air. Perhaps just to go to the point around the WHO guidelines, we have had to take policy decisions in the country because the guidelines are largely for Europe, where it is largely wet. Even in their summers, they get a lot of rain. And we have very dry winters that can take very long periods. And as a result, we have suspended particulate matter in the air that exists naturally without any industrial influence or driving or burning. So our standards have had to be adapted to our local conditions because we do have high background levels because we're a dry country. We have lots of land in South Africa that is not covered by vegetation, and that affects what we measure in the state of air. So in the valley, here's the state of air. And as I was saying, when you look close at the
can
state,
you explain that again, Tony?
What?
The deviation from the World Health Organization standards.
The World Health has guidelines. They're not standards. They are guidelines for countries to adopt for ambient levels of air. They don't have guidelines for industrial because industrial standards are according to technologies, what is achievable and what is not achievable. So the guidelines that are published by the World Health Organization are for countries to adopt. And when we adopt, we then look at our local conditions of what our prevailing ambient levels are without any influence of additional pollution, so anthropogenic, what we say, additional man-made pollution sources. And our background in South Africa is already high when it comes to particulate matter or dust because we have vast land that is not covered by vegetation and also windy areas. So there's a lot of dust that is entrained and kept in the atmosphere, which then happens as well when we have the drought periods, when it's not raining. So first of all, when it's not raining, there's that dust entrainment, but there is then also the effect that the cleaning up of the atmosphere that comes with rain does not happen, and so we have this suspended pollution that sits in the atmosphere for a longer period of time than it would if it was raining. So, and maybe I can make, some of these things are visible. When there has been a cold front, just after the cold front, you see a clear blue sky, which means that suspended pollution is no longer there. It happens also after rain. Not measured, I'm just talking about looking at the atmosphere with a naked eye. You can see that the air is a bit cleaner. That's just the point I was making around the adoption of the standards.
Well, I'm sure we'll engage with that and proceed.
Okay. So as I was saying, you can see reductions except for Clip River, and in 2015 there seems to be an increase in the PM, which is also a driver from the drought that we have been measuring. I also put some graphs on seasonal cycles just to explain what we mean by pollution signatures. If you look at the, maybe I can explain Clip River more clearly. When there's a morning and afternoon peak, it means that there is a source that comes in and out, if I can loosely call it that. So those are intermittent sources like your vehicle emissions. In the morning there's traffic, and then during the day there's no traffic, and then there's traffic again in the afternoon. It is the same signature for domestic coal burning. But the level at which the graph sits, if you look at the blue, for example, the blue graph, which is the winters are always higher for two reasons. Drier, to start with, and also because we have the inversion layer where the pollution doesn't move out, it gets trapped in the atmosphere, and then we measure higher amounts. So it's not necessarily so much that we have new sources, that we do have new sources, like a domestic burning doesn't happen in the summer, but also we have these other meteorological conditions that facilitate the exceedances. But if the graph is high, and it starts very high, it shows that there's a continuous source, which would be an industrial source, that doesn't go in and out. It's in operation for 24 hours and it just sits there and causes the problem. PM2.5, which is the finer particulate matter affecting human health, also is taking the same pattern as the PM10, but obviously a bit different because it comes mostly from high temperature combustion, which would be industrial vehicle emissions largely, and not so much some of the local sources that are not high temperature like an industrial furnace. But if I can make the example of Clip River, as I was talking about the pollution signature, PM2.5 is constantly on a high, which means that it's a continuous source. It doesn't go in and out like you would see in deep blue when it's just one source that is persistent during the day, and in the evening it goes down because of the met conditions. We don't have an SO2 problem so much at the valley, but we still continue to enforce compliance to SO2 because SO2 secondary pollution leads to the production of the PM2.5 aerosol. And in other countries like the US, California, they started to see improvements in PM2.5 when they addressed the SO2 pollution. This is the valve as well, the pollution signature. See that it's not necessarily intermittent sources like the clue, but we do have high level sources. The high sub-hurried area, there's a data that's also non-compliant steps, just to say that the standard, the Act says once the area has come into compliance for 2 consecutive years, the minister can then undeclare it as a priority area, but in this area, clearly we are not at the point of considering the undeclaring, because we still have a persistent pollution problem, and for 2015 you can see. But we also changed the monitoring system. This is the signature. We have high-level sources, which makes a very high background. So as soon as the intermittent sources come in to contribute, you see sources very, very largely in those areas. PM2.5 takes the same signature, slightly different, because the sources are somewhat different. I think the pollution signatures are far more clear in the high-field PM2.5. You can see that some of the sources are very significant intermittent sources. And studies have found that where people live closer to the coal mines, obviously they tend to burn more coal in their homes than those who live further, because they don't have access to so much of the coal, which is another issue that needs to be looked into when we address the issues of domestic burning. SO2, we seem to be resolving the problems, but as I said, SO2 can never be ignored because of the contribution to the PM2.5 in pollution. And we do have a lot of sources of continuous SO2 in the high field in the form of the power generation. All power generation using coal contributes largely to SO2 emissions. SO2 signature. Looking at Middleburg and Hendrina, it's clear industrial signature where the inter is a continuous source. It gets high peaks during the day, which is not consumed with a local source that comes in and out. Waterberg parish area, Waterberg Bojanala, I forgot the word Bojanala then, was declared as a precautionary measure, but when we start monitoring, we see that there are already incidences of which are mining operations. Mining makes a very big contribution to dust and PM10 and trade, particularly if it's going to be open cast, but also the transportation of the product within the fence line also affects the contribution. 2.5 is also the same. And SO2 clearly not a problem in the water.
Remarks. Mr. Grant Walter is going to do the actual presentation, Chair. But just to note, for members to note that it's a very complex area to enforce, and Dr. Tuli has actually given a good indication of some of the areas and the nature of the pollution as well as the different role players that contribute to the pollution sources. So from the department's perspective, we've taken a strategic approach to compliance and enforcement. And we do that with the assistance of the line functions by looking at specific areas and targeting specific industries as well. Chair, we also need to consider that the approach that we take needs to be sustainable. It was mentioned in the previous presentation that we have to consider issues such as social, economic, and environmental issues because these are large industries. There's jobs that are related to these industries as well. So the approach we take is to ensure that we get industry to comply within the shortest possible period of time before we actually get to actual enforcement. So the approach is that we try and take a facilitatory approach to ensure that they come into compliance. But Grant, during his presentation, will take you through the actual issues and what we've done in this area from an enforcement perspective.
Okay. Thank you, Chief. Yeah, before that, maybe just to Tuli, the VAL, by the way, the VAL, what did you say was the reason why there was a sort of a long outstanding submission to the minister? The VAL report.
Sorry, Chair, what was that?
You didn't get the question.
I didn't hear it.
No, I thought you were going to also speak. You were speaking about the Highveld. We got a presentation about the Highveld.
Yes.
The VAL report that we wanted to be briefed. Initially, the minister said she didn't receive it, and you received it about June last day, July.
Yeah, Chair. The reality is that the minister has a huge amount on her plate, and we are briefing minister fully as soon as we can get an opportunity to, and there is no particular reason. It's not that we're trying to hold back or anything like
but
that.
But was it submitted to her office?
Yes, we have. Look, Chair, we will get that briefing done for the Minister and we will release the report. There is nothing in that report that is of particular concern, so we do want to brief the Minister as soon as possible.
Okay, so the problem was availability. It was not that the report was sitting in the office and not being entertained.
Yes, Chair. But I think just also to come in as a follow-up from Judy's point, the minister wants a briefing because of the language of a health study, this human health risk assessment things. So it's not so much that the report isn't there. It's to explain it, to talk about the vulnerability maps and how the sampling was conducted and all of that information, so that she can then approve it and present it to the right forum before she then brings it here. But the issue, as Judy has indicated, has been the volume of work that is sitting on the table.
Okay. No, I just needed to understand that because initially we just brushed it off and without really putting much more emphasis on it, because the report was about the what is happening in the valve in terms of the emissions there and the impact that it's having, as I understand, in the area. And I thought that the sooner we release that, the better, so that appropriate action can be taken. And also those, so that, because the reports are commissioned for a reason and there are resources associated with commissioning of reports. So it's really not acceptable that we sit for such a long time. I'm saying in future, please make sure that as soon as you get the report, you brief the relevant principals as soon as possible, and so that it can be released for the information of the whoever the report was intended to, include in Parliament in future, because really it's unacceptable 11 months. Probably had we not requested it here, it was still going to sit for God knows how many months was it going to be sitting on the table. let's get the enforcement and compliance.
Thank you.
Tell us your name.
Okay, so my name is Grant Walters. I'm the Director of Enforcement responsible for waste and pollution enforcement in the country.
Okay.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. I think the last bullet point is the instruction that we received from the Portfolio Committee, and that is to look at the current initiatives and status quo when it comes to compliance and enforcement with the minimum emission standards. However, the presentation has been compiled in such a way that what I'm presenting is a holistic view of the compliance profile of certain industries, which includes obviously their commitments to the minimum emission standards. But in order to get there, it's very important for us just to outline how compliance and enforcement actually is taken within the environmental sector. So what I'll be touching on very briefly is the approach to compliance and enforcement, understanding the role of the Department of Environmental Affairs versus the local authorities. As Dr. Kumalo has pointed out, is that our local authorities forms quite an important component of the compliance and enforcement strategy when it comes to air quality related matters. So within the sector, it's a facilitated approach that we take. It's really to get industries back into the regulatory net, which really does take a number of years. A whole lot of our activities and action focuses on planning. It's really coordinated and strategic. We utilize or we rely quite heavily on our administrative enforcement mechanisms that are at our disposal, so that would constitute your compliance notices and your directives. And as an absolute last resort, we go to our criminal enforcement action. I think from a compliance and enforcement perspective is that it really is a balancing act between ensuring the integrity of the legislative framework, but also recognizing other important areas within government. So fiscal growth, looking at job security, and also certain other imperatives from a constitutional point of view. If you look at just administrative enforcement action, it needs to be aligned with, or it needs to be in proportion to the damage-causing activity. So for us to rush in and to shut down a facility might not be in compliance to those obligations. Within the waste and pollution sector, as specifically within the air quality sector, as Dr. Kumalo has pointed out, is that it involves quite complex science. it really is the historical pollution that we're trying to address, which requires quite a bit of time for a facility to actually come into compliance. A lot of the technology requires retrofitting. So outdated technology, and one of the examples that I'll point out a little bit later in the presentation is that it takes a significant amount of money to bring a facility into compliance. From a complexity point of view is that we rely quite heavily on our line functions, which is Dr. Kumalo and her team, to provide us that strategic direction in pointing out exactly what the non-compliances are, how to go about facilitating compliance. So it is really conflict on that front.
Move a bit faster, no?
All right. From a compliance and enforcement strategy perspective is that the strategy has really been developed around these different areas of work. So you'll see that quite a significant amount of the attention goes into compliance promotion, compliance-related activities before we go into criminal enforcement action, which is really the last resort in terms of ensuring compliance. And our strategic indicators are also set up in that point, so it's not only from a quantitative perspective, which is number of compliance inspections, it also looks at the administrative notices that we issue, but what is the percentage compliance that we actually achieve by issuing these notices? So it's really impact-driven. What we've got is we've got the real indication of what compliance profile of facility looks like in terms of that administrative enforcement. And as I said, the criminal prosecution and criminal cases is the absolute last resort. So a very small percentage of our indicators focuses on those criminal indicators. So from a compliance promotion and a compliance monitoring perception, is that back in 2006 when the inspectorate was formed, we looked at five different sectors and baseline studies were done in those sectors. We tried to facilitate compliance. So many of the examples that you will see later on is the facilitated developmental approach to getting a facility into compliance. Follow-up inspection has been done over a period of time, and only when the compliance behavior of a facility is of such a nature that it requires criminal enforcement action is then referred to my team to take that action. But as I say, that is as an absolute last resort, ensuring compliance. So as I say, a lot of activities or a lot of our actions require quite a significant amount of planning with our local authorities, with our air quality experts in the field. And as I say, it's a balancing act. Communities at this point in time are being very litigious in terms of taking their own action in terms of supporting compliance, and we've seen this play out now quite significantly in 2001 of our waste disposal sites in the Kaapstad province. But when we talk about our administrative instructions, the objective of those instructions study in this Matthews African Barrier Group, and he's really tested us on a number of fronts. He's looked at how we've taken compliance or compliance notices, what that speaks to against, coupled with criminal enforcement action, and how that also now plays out in the criminal court. So it's been quite extensive, a big learning curve for us, but I do think that our specialists in this particular case have stood up to the challenge, and I'm sure also when it comes to equality matters, the same lesson. So when we started off with our compliance and enforcement action, it was taken in those five areas, which was the Operation Fairer, the five areas, the main industry, paper and pulp and hazardous waste. And some of the examples that I will use now fit into those categories. And as I said, to isolate only the minimum emission standards from your overall compliance and enforcement strategy against a particular facility, I'll be discussing those interchangeably. But one of the very good outcomes was the ArcelorMittal Vereniging, where we moved a facility where there were extensive fugitive emissions to a situation where over 220 million rand was spent on an elephant bagger system to get rid of those emissions. So that is, in the air quality space, that is the quantum that we're talking about in terms of retrofitting a facility in order to bring them into compliance. So those are kind of the quantums that we're talking about. Understanding the role of here versus local authority is that a lot of action is taken from our local municipal officials, and they are EMI environmental management centers that operate within our local authority. We as we have a very small area of work that I would think we get involved with within the air quality space. However, in terms of the schedules to the constitution, it does not rule out pollution control, and there is where we get in and we do a lot of capacity initiatives with local authorities in terms of undertaking the compliance and enforcement action against specific facilities. I think the rollout of environmental management inspectors within the local authorities only happened about 2014, so they're really new in terms of taking those administrative enforcement action coupled with criminal investigation. To get into the presentation now we have taken quite a number of lift activities within hydro or priority areas over two cycles, and that has kind of given us a very good indication of what the compliance behavior is at this point in time, and what the performance of facilities are specifically in relation to those postponed decisions that we should buy as well. So Dr. Mahler has presented roadmap that we monitor in terms of where those facilities are. I'll be completely dishonest if I say that everything is rosy. That is not the case. There are areas where there are significant improvement caused by our actions. There are significant improvements that were done purely by compliance promotion activities. But unfortunately, there are those areas where we have had to focus in and really had dedicated enforcement action in order to achieve a specific goal more aligned to those postponement decisions that have been drawn by the department. So it has played out over two cycles. There were 13 dedicated facilities that we've zoned into. Administrative enforcement action, as I said, is the default tool that we rely on to keep compliance in the sector. And there's quite a number of other activities that set out in our National Environmental Compliance and Enforcement Report. This will come out towards the latter end of this year, where there's more detail given. So these are the facilities that we've been targeting in terms of certain postponement decisions that have been issued. Also just looking holistically at the compliance profile of the facilities in terms of the duty of care obligations and a whole range of other requirements in terms of environmental law. So this particular facility in Malahleni, I think when we had the last oversight visit where I was part of, about 2 years ago, the previous chairperson of portfolio committee said to us that this is a particularly problematic facility.
an administrative enforcement approach. This facility has been coupled with criminal enforcement action, and I'll talk a little bit about that as well. So in 2007, when we first dealt with the facility, about 54 non-compliances were detected in line with the strategy. We gave them opportunities to come into compliance. They presented certain areas where they will improve. That obviously didn't happen in 2009 when we gave them an additional opportunity to make representations. Obviously, we were aware at that point in time that over 3,000 people were employed at this particular facility. And that is where that balancing act came into in terms of our action. And in 2015, we could see, look, and this was quite a number of years after that 2009 action was taken, was that the facility was just not demonstrating compliance at all, which left us with little option at this point in time but to engage them from that administrative enforcement action point of view to give them certain ultimatum. At this point in time, what happened then was that a business rescue process went up. Happened, and the facility came to us and said, well, we can't actually comply with our permit obligations at this point in time, and what we have in terms of outcome was really just in terms of efficiency, in terms of operating this plant within certain design parameters. They were not operating the plant efficiently at all, and came about that the facility was then shut down, not really just from an environmental perspective, but holistically, they were just spending way too much money in terms of operating the facility. What then happened was that in the background, the structural mill, I think many probably would have seen, I would have displayed how the structural mill has been. As well, I think one of the issues here is that we there a line in the sand was drawn. We're looking at the compliance behavior of the facility as well, in terms of a technical assessment that is currently ongoing within the department. And as soon as that is done, we'll be able to say how we're going to push the facility forward. But just in terms of actions, is that two of the incinerators were shut down. Obviously, also over a period of time when we had to engage in terms of that administrative process. In terms of the hazardous waste-related sector, and this is a facility that operates within the healthcare earthquake environment, is that follow-up inspections have been done now. I think 2016 we had the last blip. The compliance profile did not look that great, but they've given us now a plan to come into compliance with some of the commitments. I'll finish the move now. So just in terms of action going forward, there's quite significant work that we need to do collectively with the municipal authorities in looking at just air quality emissions licenses, emissions license and compliance profile of facilities. We were quite excited to see and we noted the work that the department is doing in the fall with an air apportionment study that will obviously roll itself out towards the land department. Yeah, that study has not been finalized, but that will give us far more strategic direction in terms of who to tackle from compliance and enforcement perspective. A lot of work needs to do with local authorities capacitating them to do compliance and enforcement work. Just in terms of our actions and how this has resulted in the criminal area of work that we see, is a lot of our cases have been finalized in 105 APN sentence agreements. It is no different to what's happening in the rest of the world. So if you follow in the US instance with the BC case, is that significant settlement costs were happening in that area, which again was returned in order to do certain remedial action. The false Robin case as well in the US is another example where settlement agreement has laid out there. And then of course when we do look at criminal enforcement action, we look at the seriousness of the impact on the environment, human health and well-being aspects, the financial position of the accused, and the focus is on compensating the victim of the crime. In this particular area of work, the Department of Environmental Affairs and the Environmental Authority are seen as the victim of the crime, so if we get a compensation order, it's obviously to look at certain remedial work that takes place in that area. Just the challenges in relation to compliance and enforcement before I close down, is that there's a number of business rescue processes underway, which is seen really as a threat to ensuring the long-term commitment of the facilities. Just to build and retain certain compliance and enforcement experience within government from a technical and legal perspective is quite challenging. I think as soon as somebody gets capacitated in this field, they are headhunted and taken within industry. Obviously, we look at enabling growth. This is that fine balance with growth, ensuring fiscal growth without undermining the integrity of the legislative framework. If overlapping mandates within the sector, that obviously plays out with our local authorities. I think from our side, from a compliance and enforcement perspective, we've got a really good understanding with our local authorities. If they need assistance in certain areas, they do call upon us to help them out, and we do provide them assistance in terms of, especially when it comes to criminal enforcement work. It is really a lengthy process to bring a facility into compliance. So very basically.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for the presentation. I'm going to be leaving now in the next 15 minutes. I'm going to ask some questions later on. Hand over to Honorable Makuvela. I'm worried about your introductory remarks.
on this issue, that you don't only look at being strict in ensuring compliance, but you look at other socio-economic issues to make sure that the company or the industry can proceed doing its work, irrespective of the fact that it does not comply. I've got a serious and fundamental problem with that approach. Your duty is to ensure compliance, irrespective of what. If industry wants to apply for postponement to comply, let them apply. If it is not granted, they've got a responsibility to comply. So it is not for you to decide whether a company complies with the law or does not comply. Yours is to make sure that it's enforcement. And I'm really worried about that approach, and I hope that it is not what I think it is now, because that is going to be a problem. Your duty as enforcement and compliance to make sure that the rules as they are must be complied with. That's the first point that I want to make. The second one, we have done an oversight to Eskom and to Sasol. We received the presentation from Eskom, from the department, as well as from two NGOs, Groundwork and the Val, the other one that operates in the Vault and the Highveld. And there were issues that were raised around Eskom, and I think as well as Sasol. So we requested them to give us their response. We did say they must respond to the issues raised. They have not yet responded. We wrote them a letter. We gave them until the 9th. I'm not sure whether the response has come. So the response has not come from them. And then we later learned that Sasol wants to apply for further extension. We as a committee are not happy with that, because even in our engagement with Sasol, they were not convincing on how they want, or why they want to apply for further postponement. It's quite clear that there is no appetite to put the money where the, what is that say, where the mouth is. They don't want to invest in the retrofitting, in ensuring that they acquire technology to reduce the emissions. They still want to continue as business as usual. And then again, we've got a fundamental problem with that. Because industry, industry has to contribute to making sure that the establishment complies with the standards, complies with the law. Now, my understanding is that when these standards were developed, there was a wide consultation with industry, and generally it was agreed to. It's a minimum standard. And as you say, Julie, it's not really even, it's below the World Health Organization guidelines. So industry is supposed to comply, and they are not, my sense of Sasol is that they are not prepared to comply. First, they took the department to court on this thing. They were not successful. They are supposed to comply. They are not complying. What do? They submit application for further postponement, which is a problem. I wanted to comment on that, but I'll request from my side that we must get detailed reports on each of the applications for postponement that have been agreed to by the department for further postponements. So we know that they have applied. We can't say, we are saying that they should not be positively considered, but of course, you still have the responsibility to consider them according to each case has to be considered by its own merit. But we think that there is no appetite to comply from the side of industry, particularly the big emitters. I want you to report on that, but just bear in mind that we will request a detailed report on the decision that has been taken for each of those applications as soon as it is done, and would want you to come here to Parliament to justify that decisions if you do agree on the further postponements. Now, on the VAR situation, Highveld, on the Highveld, if you look at the graphs, I don't know what page is that, almost 4 p.m. particular met, from the information from monitoring stations, almost they've been exceeding the minimum standard. And you did speak to the air quality plan, which has been developed. But it looks like from the presentation here that the targets put are being exceeded. Daily average or whatever, daily, monthly, annually, there's been exceedances there in terms of what industries polluting. What are the plans to remedy the situation? Because at some point the minimum standards must be complied with. And from the enforcement side, you talk about weighing the options, which EFSA for it said, I don't think there is a choice. There's nothing to weigh, you just have to enforce compliance. What is the plan from the department in terms of making sure that the standards that have been put are not exceeded in terms of the emissions? As you can see from almost all the, I'm trying to look at that slide, I can't see it. But yeah, you know the slide that talks about the standard and the fact that the standards have been exceeded. So those are my questions. Maybe if you can just respond to that, and then later on the committee will further engage, unless if you want to add on what I've said, but there will be around two. Let's start with the TTG.
Chair, I think the important word that you use was on a case-by-case basis. You'll see from Grant's presentation, Chair, that we've got different strategies for different industries. If you're talking about taking a strict compliance approach, Chair, it would mean, for example, shutting a facility down and doing away with 3,000 jobs, for example, and the concomitant families that go with that job. So you're looking at probably 12,000 people's livelihoods that we putting at a stop immediately, Chair. So from that perspective, in terms of some of the industries, like you'll see in the presentation, we talk about where they've actually spent 272 million in one instance, 222 million in another instance, to actually come into compliance. And in those instances, it's a win-win because we've got an industry that's now almost compliant or compliant in some instances, as well as the jobs that go with that industry. And if you look at these industries, these are our big industries, steel, energy production. If we go in there and we shut down the power stations, and I think there's a lot of them that are non-compliant, it means we shut down power for the country. That's the reality of it.
Yeah, but that's exactly my point. You see, you don't determine. Legislation has been passed by Parliament. for industry to comply, the Air Quality Act. There's minimum standards that have been set. So, yours is not to make that call. Yours is to make sure that there is compliance, you see. Because it's like you're going to weigh on the one side, you will be threatened with the job losses. No, if we do this, we have to. So many jobs are going to be lost. On the other hand, there is a health impact. People are dying out of inhaling this thing. And that has also been quantified, just that at the time when they engage with you, they will not say so many people are dying as a result of our activity. So you shouldn't make that choice, that call. That call has already been made by Parliament. There is an act. There is standards that have to be met. Industry must meet the standard. If they are not, let them apply. That's the point that I'm making. Let them apply for postponement to comply. If they are exceeding, they must be stopped not to exceed. You see? So I'm saying that should not be your call, you see? And that is the orientation which is wrong, which I'm challenging the department. Because otherwise we are going to sit and allow people to pollute because they are employing 3,000 people. There's nothing we can do with them. And yet we have set the standard as a country to say we can't continue like this because there's an impact to the health of the population. People are dying. Groundwork gave us a study of so many people who are dying. It was reported in the Sunday Times. It was not contested by Eskom. I think it was in one area there in the Waterbeck about the death that are there. So I think we must agree that is not your call, DDG. That call has already been made, and I think we must just make sure that we strictly ensure that enforcement compliance is enforced. Sorry to interject you, but I feel very strong about that issue. You can respond to the other ones. So I don't expect that next time when we engage, we'll say, look, we're weighing whether to enforce, but there are jobs. Obviously, there are jobs. There's a sacrifice that has to be made. Okay, continue.
Chair, I'm going to allow Dr. Tuli to respond to some of the stuff, but your point is taken, Chair. But you'll see during the presentation that we have actually, in terms of the MES, been holding them to account. Remember, they give us a roadmap in terms of compliance, and we've been holding them to account in terms of their compliance.
Okay.
And so, in some instances where there hasn't been non-compliance, or where there has been non-compliance, we've gone the criminal route. So, what Grant was explaining is we use the administrative process initially, and then if there is non-compliance, and we then go the criminal route, but it is to bring them in line with that MES.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Perhaps just to provide clarity, the accidents that I reported in the State of Air are not accidents by industry. They are accidents by the State of Air, which is what we are measuring in the receiving environment. Industries contribute to that, and other sources as well contribute to that. So it's not directly linked that this accident means that there's a non-compliance in a particular industry, just to clarify that. On the issue of the further postponements by SASO, at this point we have not received the postponement application. And I think that is because of the way the regulatory framework is set out. They have to conduct and complete a public participation process before they bring such application to the department with all the comments and issues raised by the stakeholder consultation process. So we believe that we will receive the applications, but at this point they have not yet submitted the application. And in terms of considering those applications when they finally reach the department, we developed a framework which we use application process, and every application is assessed in its own merit. Perhaps if I can make reference to the previous report that states out clearly for each facility what the issues were and what the considerations were and where they we felt there was a need for granting a postponement. So it will be the similar report that we will bring to the committee once we have received applications and we have processed them. So if I can just give a high-level example, for the SO2 that Sasol ESCOM applied for in the hybrid, we didn't grant the postponement for that because we looked at their current performance and found that they are in compliance. So granting postponement would mean that we are giving a cap and we are saying you can go in up and down as you wish between this number and that number, which is not the point of postponement. So we declined all of those and the Sasol NITRO as well. So there are postponements that we decline and we don't grant, and the report is very specific on detail on what has been granted and what has not been granted, and the reasons for all of that are provided in the report, which is shared with the committee and the members of the public.
The exceedances, you say it's not only industries, including people burning coal in their household and so forth.
Yes, and vehicles and mining.
The what?
Vehicles as well, vehicle emissions and mining.
But how do we then make sure that the emissions are in line with the plan and the minimum standards that are set? Isn't it industry contributing more to that? What is the apportionment study saying?
Unfortunately, industry is not necessarily contributing more. And that is the critical mass of the problem, if I can put it like that. Because we have low-level sources that contribute. The challenge is that the background level, so the existing state of air, there is already pollution that exists there. So when people make fires in their homes to keep warm or for whatever reason, that is when we are now pushed to exceedances, because the quality of the air, as it were, is not at zero, no pollution like we learned in primary school, the combustion of the atmosphere. So I think for me to just explain that the interaction of the pollution in the receiving environment, the minimum emission standards are based purely on what industrial operations should achieve in terms of existing technologies in the world that can come into compliance. And the ambient now are the impact standards, if I can call it that, that are measuring the state of air, which is what we breathe in and out, that affects or does not affect our health. That's the distinction between the two. In terms of what we are doing too, we are implementing the air quality management plans in these areas, and there are different strategies of government that are looking to reduce the pollution. But I think we should also then be honest, some of the sources are not local, like the biomass burning that happens across Africa and the air parcels are transported here. We measure signatures of that. Biomass burning, it happens also largely in the Western Cape, completely uncontrolled. But it does have the impact to the state of air. Mining, for example, is a big contributor because industries make a contribution, but at a very high level. So I've made the example of an ESCOM stack in the past to say it may sit 40 kilometers from me as a person sitting here. And even though the pollution may be high, if but there's time for that pollution to travel in the atmosphere and get mixed up with air before it gets to the people, as opposed to the fire that I make in my home, that I inhale the pollution direct. So the approach in the priority area is not to address one source and leave the other, to address all of them, because we have done models where we have seen that if we were to address air pollution from domestic burning only, we would still have accidents. Similarly for the industries, we address industries only, we still have accidents. So it's the full suite of what government is putting into place to reduce the pollution from all the sources, obviously at different rates depending on the complexity of the source, but all the sources need to reduce. On the question, questions answered.
Okay, I've just been told my meeting has been postponed. We're not even told that. So I'm still here until we finish. Honorable Khadela and Honorable Kekan and Honorable Nyambi.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to have two fingers on the issue of particular matter in the high priority area. I think my main concern is that we've got air quality management plans. Do we sit around with these plans for the entire, like, I see it's from 2010 up to 2015, are they reviewed annually to see what kind of interventions that needs to be made in order to lessen the impact? Because it seems that there is no annual reviewing of the air quality or AQMP of annual air quality management plan. They don't do the review annually so that they can look at the intervention. I think the chair raised the issue of laxity. I also wanted to stress on that, but I think you have spoken about that enough. I don't want to sound like a stress record. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Do we know fairly well how much of pollution that occurs in a particular area? For example, Chair, in Zambela, comes from local community itself, and how much comes from the major industries? Has any study scheme done in this regard, or one we yet to conduct them in pollution hotspots? And then on page 7, fire station, I've seen only 4 bullets here, not 5.
Where?
On page 7, they state 5 stations, but now here it's 4.
Oh, they added secondary. Honorable Nyambi.
Thanks, Chair. On the HIFES report, they talk about the domestic planning office, but they said a lot still needs to be done. Then, Chairperson, now, if the domestic burning occurs in an already highly polluted background community, who are aware of this fact, how do you expect them to perceive themselves as a problem when they live in a neighborhood of power plants and steel manufacturing industries? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Kubera.
Just a few from nature. The administrative action that gets taken and thereafter considering criminal charges, how long does it take? How do you determine that now is enough, the company or industry is just not ready, and we must move swiftly to criminal charges? The second one, I know that some of these industries come with offset programs. How do we reconcile that with non-compliance? Is that to say, because we have got these offset programs, then consider this thing and allow us space not to comply for some time? The third point, have we by now, as a country, been able to determine the anthropogenic or anthropogenical activities? We quantified that as opposed to the state of air before these activities. to then be able to say, or which led to us determining the deviation to WHO standards. The last but one chair, the human capital that we're saying gets pushed or whatever, which apparently is not there, particularly at the local government level, which would allow those institutions to be able to monitor and enforce compliance. To what extent is it affecting negatively the compliance or what is its impact at that level in terms of ensuring that compliance happens? Lastly, Chair, I'm interested in understanding the participation or involvement of the Department of Health, so that when we deal with issues of compensation and these offsets, it could be measured on those factors. Because if you don't have that understanding, and they come with offsets that are not anywhere closer to what the health impacts are in such an area, you may be addressing a wrong challenge. If I'm making my point clear, that if people are dying of certain challenges and you come there and address it differently, you provide electricity when in fact you needed to deal with something else. And I'm not saying it's only the Department of Health that could come clearly on what may need to happen to compensate for the health of the people in that regard. Thanks.
Thanks. Just to amplify what the question of Honorable Khadebe, you develop a quality plan. What is the value of these plans if there's continuous exceedances? Because my understanding is that the plan must help to reduce the levels of emissions in a priority area. So why do we develop a plan and yet there are continuous exceedances of what you plan to reduce? So there is no reduction despite the fact that you have put a plan. So what is the value of the plan? The areas were identified as high priority areas. The Vaal, Highveld, and the Waterberg and Bujana. The Vaal and Highveld was declared when 2007. Pardon? In 2007. It's what, almost 10 years now. Has there been any improvement in the quality of ambient air quality in the particular areas ever since the declaration was made and the plan was developed to reduce that? There's been applications for postponement which were granted, and there's fresh applications from Sasol and ESCO. You say that there's still some, they have to conduct public participation hearing. Of course, the community told us the nature of that engagement, that it is not thorough, it's not qualitative. It is just the ticking of the box. So that probably will happen, and they will then submit the applications. Now, obviously I know that you'll say to us that you can't comment because you have not received the application. postponement application. Is there a deadline to say we can extend up to 2020 but not beyond? We can extend up to 2025, not beyond. Up to when are you going to say, especially from the priority areas, because where I'm seated, the reason why you declare an area priority area is because you want to focus on and make sure that there is a reduction in emissions from industry or from all the sources of pollution. So up to when are you going to consider those postponed, especially from the high priority areas? And maybe something that you may want to follow it up to us in writing. In the priority areas, do you have a sense of the pollution levels per facility? And which ones are exceeding the targets or the minimum standards that you've set? Which ones are not? So you'll take the Vaal, Highveld, and Waterberg, Bujanala, and look at the facilities that are there all in all, and check each one of them, the levels of pollution, and whether are they high or they are complying or not. Do you have that information? Can you give us that information in writing? Honorable Khader.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, for giving me the opportunity. I just forgot two important questions. The other one, I wanted to know how many mines we have been given license to, or have been given rights to mine in the priority area. And secondly, how many coal-powered power stations that have applied for licenses to operate in the priority areas, all of the three of them. And then the other issue, Chair, which seems to be a concern for me, is issue of capacity in the local municipality. It seems always like we are waiting as a department to be approached by the municipalities in order to be able to go to them and do capacity building, which I don't think is a good strategy. We need to be strategic and identify certain municipalities where we feel we need to reduce the impact and reduce pollution, and say these are the kinds of training that we can offer you, especially when it comes to enforcement. Because if we don't have people on the ground to do the enforcement, we can have all these plans, and yes, we can have all these plans and everything, but it won't make any difference if you are not enforcing our policies as well as legislation. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. The licensing of mines, is it not minerals? Or atmospheric what license? AEM. Okay. Oh, okay. Right, you've got quite a number there. Is it a cell phone? Okay, Tula.
Thank you, Chair. I have a list of opportunities.
Yeah, and just before, just tell us who takes the decision to grant further postponements as part of answering our question.
The first one, Chair, is around the annual review of the AQMP. Yes, it's true, we don't review the aquatic management plans annually. We produce implementation reports annually. The set a review period in the national framework is 5 years because of the nature of interventions. They are long-term interventions. So in a five-year period, we then review the aquatic management plan. The reason we have not reviewed the two current ones now, it's because we are waiting for the source apportionment study to show us who the big contributors are so that we can target those sources. We have emissions inventories that have a total emissions, but an emissions inventory is according to the contribution. It's not according to what we are measuring in the state of air. So what we do with the social questionnaire study is to look at the pollution from the receptor site, where the pollution reaches, and you say, if 5 is here, where did 2 come from, 3 come from, and if I can make a loose example. We can review the equality management plans according to the inventory that we have, but it may, which is how we set the current targets, by the way. But we are seeing that there is an opportunity to improve on the interventions that we have based on what reaches the receptor. And that's the agreement we've taken in the value. The study has been initiated, and we are going to do 2 campaigns for the winter and the summer, so we can determine whether the sources are actually different according to the different seasons. So annually, we produce an implementation plan, and the review period is a 5-year period, which at the moment we are waiting for the sufficient. Because even with that, the state of air keeps informing us where we are going, and then you check the state of air, you can see that the implementation that is happening is not being measured at the same rate. Then we did the source apportionment study. In terms of apportioning in each area, what the major contributions are, yes, we have that information at a high level. It's going to be improved when we finish the source apportionment, but we know the major pollution sources in the areas. If I can take some data as an example, even though in other townships, the bigger portion comes from domestic burning of coal in the homes, in Zamdela, the local sources are coming from waste, uncollected waste, the burning of waste. So the program that we are doing there is around waste collection, because that is the local source as opposed to the number of households that are burning coal. So we do have a level of understanding of what the local pollution sources would be, but it's different from area to area. That is why when we did the offsets, we looked at the specifics of each of those areas. And I will add to that as I answer the other question. The chair had corrected the question around the 5 stations that I, when I was speaking, I added Secunda. And the other question was whether we expect people to perceive themselves as a problem when it comes to the issue of domestic burning. Chair, the approach we have taken in the priority areas is that based on the understanding of how the sources are interacting in the ambient space is a non-finger-pointing approach. Of course, the issues of domestic burning are largely socio-economic. That is why the route that the minister has taken is not to establish a legislation like they did in Europe, where they had alternative sources of energy. Rather, to develop a strategy that looks at provision of alternatives to the coal, so that people have the choice of whether to burn coal or not, because at the moment, that is what is available to them. Yes, so we are addressing the problem, but not directly like you would with industry putting out a legislation and expecting compliance. I think Grant is going to talk with the administrative action. Can I proceed? You just wanted to get the end. The offset, the question was how do we reconcile that with the non-compliance? It is not a substitute. An offset project is not a substitute of what exists in the compliance roadmap. So we handle the two processes separately. If I can make an example, in Grant's presentation, he spoke about the incinerators at Sasol that are found to be non-compliant with the emission limits given in the postponement. So it's not to say because Sasol is implementing an offset in Zamdela, we should then forget that they're in non-compliance with other limits. So the two are being handled at the same time. So there's no substitute. If you are doing an offset, it's an additional requirement. It's not a substitute for what you need to do at the steps that we have in the legislation.
But is that the understanding of industry?
Of what?
Of industry.
Yes, they understand that very well, because we are working on compliance roadmaps together with the requirements for the offset. There's no.
But that's not the impression that I got when we met with ESCOM and when we met with Sasol. They think that offset program, it's an integral part of their compliance to the standards. That's at how they presented and the resources that they are spending to do this offset program, which was very little in my view, if you ask me. But anyway, proceed. But I got a sense that they don't seem to, they think it's part of their compliance. That part of their compliance means that they have to do this offset program and invest the resources in doing the offset. Remember they showed us a nice video there trying to justify that they are doing something about compliance with the minimum emission standards, ESCOM. Yeah, but proceed there.
Sure, that is not, I don't know how to say this, but if they say it's part of the compliance, yes, it would be true, because we've made it a requirement for license to operate, to do both the compliance with what is provided for in the legislation, and additionally to do the postponement, the offset. So if, for example, they were investing in offsets and not investing in the pollution control technology that they promised in the roadmap, fabric filter plant, no, low NOx burners and all of that, they would be in non-compliance. Similarly, if they put all the pollution control technology and don't do the offset that we've made a requirement, they would be in non-compliance. So because we've added the offsets to current compliance requirements, dealing with them in that full spectrum is looked at as compliance, but it's not a substitute. So in the quarterly reports that they submit to us, they give specific indication on the stack emissions that they are supposed to reduce according to the compliance roadmaps that they submitted to us. So I think maybe it's an issue of language or of how they stated that. The next question was around whether we have determined the contribution of anthropogenic sources to the problem. I think the challenge in the whole of Africa is that we did not start monitoring long before any industries came into the space. So by the time we started monitoring air pollution in the continent, there was industry existing. There was domestic burning. There was all these other sources that I was talking about. So that is why largely the work that we do is around all of them. But we do have what we call background stations that sit in areas where there's no direct source of pollution, that not as a data station, we're obviously measuring industrial and domestic pollution at the same time. So we have a few background stations and we can share what we're measuring from those background stations, because that's where we are basing the argument that our background levels are naturally high. Some of the instruments is put in the coast station, which is not influenced by any necessarily anthropogenic sources. But sometimes, like there's another station, we thought it would be a background station, but what we are measuring is an influence of pollution transport to this particular area that's not necessarily generated locally, but long-range transport. Issues around the human capital at the municipality. I think, personally, I think we have come a long way. We have capacity now in local government like we've never had before. Issues around training and designation of AMIs, maybe Grant can address that. But in terms of capacity right now to manage air quality, especially in the priority areas, that capacity exists. We are fearful because history tells us that people get pushed or people just move around the sector as well, but we have sufficient capacity to conduct the functions. And we have different systems in the department to assist in the event that the people move. We do have a transitional period that we assist, especially in the priority areas, because we have implementation task teams, and it's not one municipality that shares. So for example, inside Divang, the post was vacant for a while, and we got the officer from Mfuleni to do the work while we are waiting for the Divang to appoint, and they have now appointed. Department of Health involvement. In our work with Department of Health, which is our starting point, has been around the strategy for low-income communities. We are bringing them on board, but the challenge that we have found, which we have asked them to address directly, is that in the there is what they call communicable disease register, the diseases that they record and communicate, like your HIV, hypertension, number of pregnancies, and all of them. The respiratory illnesses that would be exacerbated by air pollution are not necessarily part of that register, except for cardiovascular, which they look at in terms of hypertension and all of that. So the beginning, what we are doing with them is to first get those diseases to be in the register so that every clinic in the country can record those, so that we get to know how many of our people get affected. The most comprehensive register now is from the medical aid, which is not useful because it's a different population group that can afford to have medical aid. So we have started working with them to say, at least as a starting point, these diseases should be recorded in every clinic so we can begin to mine the data and make sense of it, and whether we are making improvements or not, we can look at that data. But as a starting point, when we want to just make those definitions, we conduct door-to-door interviews, and which is done in the essay that is going to be presented later. The other question was whether there's value in the plan if there's exigencies. What we are measuring in the ambient air is that there are improvements in the state of air. The challenge is that we have not reached compliance, but we are seeing slow but sure improvements over time. And perhaps, DDG, we can present the National Air Quality Indicator and the specific quality indicators to show that. In the Val, for example, before it was declared, there was a continuous cloud of red smoke, which is no longer there. There is still pollution, visible pollution from ArcelorMittal, because the dust is red, it's discarded steel that they are processing there. But due to enforcement action, they put a back house. So more than 90% of the pollution that was going out has been reduced using that back house. So personally, I'm confident and we'll reach compliance. The only challenge is too slow. We would want to reach compliance tomorrow, but the reality is that it takes time to get to the point of compliance. So I am confident that the plans that we have in place are addressing the problem. Slowly but surely, but we want to fast track those achievements and get to the point of compliance as soon as it is indeed possible. I think, Chair, when we receive the applications for postponement, we will look and engage further on the participation processes, because we have not been aware that it's just a ticking of the box. We thought it's a full journal process that is prescribed by the department, as we had done that. So we are going to look into it if the communities are stating that it's a ticking of the box, to ensure that it is done according to the prescripts of the department, because the government is very clear on how public participation must be conducted as it comes to the National Environmental Management Act. The next one was a report to be submitted in writing that talks to the pollution levels in facilities in the priority areas and which are complying and which are not, which can be brought at a later stage.
But it doesn't exist.
The information, because facilities are supposed to report quarterly on their compliance, we can compile it. Every facility within AA has a quarterly requirement to report whether they're in compliance with it or not. So it's not compiled and sitting in one document, because the AAL authorities obviously are different and they are spread across the areas, but we can compile that information and produce one report of all the facilities in the priority area.
Okay. Yeah, we want to get that report maybe in the next parliamentary term, when we come back from recess in the council term. How long does it take to produce that?
Can we get back on that one? Because as I said, the municipalities are many, and they are, we need to gather the information. Can I ask the district Judy to get back with a date so that we can do that? The information exists. It's just not sitting in one place. It's sitting with the municipalities.
They report to the municipalities.
They report to the licensing authority. That's the legal requirement. Yes. Because the licensing authority is the one that is responsible for managing that area.
We need to get a sense of how many of these facilities
and what is the level of emissions and whether they are complying or not complying. There shouldn't be, it's not thousands and thousands of them.
But it's a big number, Chair. It's a very big number, especially when you look at municipalities like Emurulen.
Yeah, it's not a small number. I think our interest is in the high priority area.
Emurulen is part of the high field priority area.
Yeah, we want to look at the high priority areas, these industries, whether they are complying or not complying. because it will also help us to, when we do our oversight, we can then go to these ones that you have reported non-compliance. It will also help the enforcement in the department to look at these ones which are not complying with the standard. So it will be, if we can get that report at least in the next term by August, September, it will help us to finalize our oversight program for the end of the year when we rise for December.
Okay, so do you want to give,
yeah, August, September, if you can work around that period, I'm sure it shouldn't be difficult to get that information. Unless it takes more than a month for municipality to give you information. And it means our system then will not be working. All right.
How many qualified stations have applied for AELs? That is also information that we need to collect and submit, but we do know that there are new coal-fired power plants that are applying for AELs, which I think for me, depending on how you look at the problem as it exists, I think we need obviously to move to renewable energies, but in terms of the industrial sector as it is, it's not... I don't know how to put it. It's not such a bad thing. Let me explain what I mean. If you look at Eskom Kutfle power plant, it's old technology built in the 50s. Moving, trying to get into compliance with existing plant standards, to move into new plant standards in the future or to shut down. If you have new industries, they have to comply with the new plant standards. There's no leeway to start with existing to new. So I think it's a complex discussion in the sense that if there's a new industry, first of all, the pollution will be far less and will give us a claim as a society to shut down the old ones that are polluting. So I'm saying it's not ideal because we should be renewable and having zero emissions for our power, but it provides some form of transition that is better than where we are currently. Not the best, but a bit better than where we are currently. Because if we had increased capacity and we did not need so much the old fleet to run, then we can start a conversation around putting off the old fleet and having cleaner burning industry. And we have seen examples. In the high field, for example, there's a new cement plant that has been built that came to make a presentation in the meeting with NGOs and communities. Very clean burning plant. I mean, what we would want to transform the industry to, as opposed to the 1950-something plants that are just, you know, polluting and dragging the economy down, in if we can look at it. So I'm saying this is a complex discussion that would need to be handled on its own. Capacity building programs in the municipalities, yes, we do not wait for municipalities. We can, I think, perhaps with that report, Judy, that looks to how many facilities are there, whether they're complying or not, we can provide a list of the capacity building initiatives that we have with municipalities, because it's quite a lot. It's quite a lot that we deal with municipalities in terms of building capacity. Then the last one was, who takes the decision to grant further postponement? According to the legislative framework, the National Air Quality Officer, with the concurrence of those licensing authorities that are responsible for managing those AELs, make those decisions to grant or not to grant postponement.
And up to when? I asked that question. Up until when will you continue granting this extension? Is there a limit to that, especially in the priority areas?
Chair, the Legal Framework does not have a date that actually limits that. And perhaps it's because of the nature of the assessments themselves. But we don't expect that many industries will come back, because if, even with the previous site where we had 34 applications, 34 out of over 1,000 AELs that we manage in the country shows that there is that move towards compliance. It's just that the problem is those industries are sitting where the problem actually does exist. So we don't expect that in the next, the 2020 period, for example, we will have another huge number of applications, because some of the facilities right now that applied in 2015 are operating at new plant standards. So your engine is already complying with 2020 standards. The cement plants are also looking to comply with 2020 standards. BP is one of those that is already now complying with 2020 standards. Anglo asked for the postponement in view to invest towards 2020 compliance, not 2015 and then 2020. So it's different considerations for the different applications, but the legislative framework does not state the date, and it is because also of the considerations for ambient air quality, not managing the sources selectively.
So you can you can apply for FedEx postponement, you grant them, and they come again, you grant them.
I wouldn't say that, Chair, because every postponement application is handled in its merit. It's not that because they have applied, then it must be granted. So I wouldn't say the application then says you must grant.
Yes.
I'm just saying the legal framework doesn't say from this date no more applications, because administration is
too late. There are two big polluters in this country, Eskom and Sasol. Sasol, quite clearly, they are not in an appetite to comply. That's what we observe when we meet with them. They say they will postpone until 2030, almost moving towards 2050 there. So they will do further postponements. And then there is Eskom. Eskom, in fact, talks about rolling postponements, clearly showing their intention to further ask for postponement for postponement. I thought there is a deadline where we say now everybody else must comply. If it's not in the Act, then it means we must make sure that we, as lawmakers, we then make sure that we amend that Act to put a deadline, because we can't have further postponement infinity.
Chair, we will look into that matter, noting that what the intention of that particular provision is to get industry gradually into compliance.
Yes.
So we will look into it.
Industry has to comply, and industry must be made to comply. They can invest in compliance. And you wanted to come in?
Okay, Chair, there was just two things that I think Honorable Makubela wanted to know about, administrative enforcement and the criminal enforcement, and when we decide which one we're going to take, I think it was the question. Chair, just to emphasize that administrative enforcement is still enforcement. Just a different method of enforcement. So in some instances we go only administrative enforcement, where we usually get compliance. In other instances where it's a severe infraction, then we go administrative and criminal. The thing though is that both those instances, whether it's administrative enforcement or criminal enforcement, they're both reportable, in the sense that that company, in terms of the King Four, they have to report that on their financial statements. And I think that's also a further step to ensuring that they come into compliance. So it just depends on a case-by-case basis when we go both or either. And then the other issue terms of Honorable Khadebe, in relation to municipalities, Honorable Khadebe, we don't wait for them. We actually have an active program. For example, in our 2016-17 financial year, we had an increase in the number of EMIs by 46 EMIs, which is about almost 18%, just in the local authorities. There were about 148 local authority officials that we've trained in terms of the EMI training, and they're awaiting their designation by the MECs. They come primarily from KZN, Western and Northern Cape. And then also the provinces are reporting that the EMIs are attending their provincial EMI air quality and waste forums. And they also now, the provinces are, have a working group that's similar to the National Working Group 4, where the, you talked about capacitation, where the municipal officials are being capacitated by their respective provinces as well.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's that. you know, Tuli, somebody's. I'm reading a document here where they are quoting the department's medium term review of the air quality management plans. And what is the, this line is different from what you say? That you are happy there is improvement in the high priority areas of. I just want to quote it. It says measured ambient data does not indicate any significant improvement in air quality since the gazetting of the air quality management plan. This data also indicates significant exceedances of the national ambient air quality standards. It is clear from that, from this and measured results for other pollutants, that ambient air quality is still a concern in the high priority area. It's from the medium term review, but you are saying that you are happy there's a significant improvement. And this line from the review says otherwise. Anyway, the further postponement, I think we must develop a different attitude towards this thing. The fact that legislation says all industry must comply, but if there's no compliance, there must be application for further postponement. Clearly the intention is to don't make it indefinite. At some point people must comply. So you need to take that attitude when you deal with this compliance application. You shouldn't only say that I've got the power to grant this application, but you must look at the intention of this legislation to grant that power. That at some point people must comply. At some point the quality of of the air that we breathe needs to improve, and it is through this legislation that it can improve. That industry must play its part, everybody else must play their part, so that we improve this. This has got a relationship with the what we were talking about earlier, the climate change issues. These issues are related somehow. So we are going to close the meeting. You want to clarify something?
Well, Chair, I think just I'm not quite sure what report you were reading from there, but I think what Tuli has presented is how complex the air quality issue is and how complex air quality management is, with the multiple sources, the fact that meteorological conditions change the air quality exceedances. So you'll have worse exceedances one season than you will have in another season. So the question is the extent to which overall there are measures of progress versus the extent to which there are exceedances at times. And we are completely with you in the fact that our air quality is a problem. It's a problem in the priority areas. That's why we are doing the work that we are trying to do. That's why we are working towards dealing with air quality in the priority areas. But it is a complex issue, and it is over time that we will have the progress that we need.
Okay. So I was submitting something here, but apparently there was a midterm review, draft report of February 2016. This passage is coming from there. That I'm reading. It's apparently a dear report. Yeah. Which says the same. You want to comment on that too?
If I may, I want to comment on that. It's like, I don't know, I can make an example of a car that is driving at 80 kilometers on, that the cops can bust it for. You can say, the person can say, I've reduced speed, I was at 120. But the reality is right now, you're in non-compliance with the speed limit. So if I can make that example, from our side, I base the statements that I'm making on measurements, which is what we are measuring in the stations. The stations are showing reductions, small reductions over time. We are still not happy because there are still exceedances, but we are not where we were before. So I think that is the point that I'm making, that if these reductions go consistently, over time we would reach compliance, but we don't have the time to wait for consistency. That's why we are pushing to say we need to come into compliance. So the DR report, yes, talks to the exceedances, and the reasons are there. But there is an improvement from where we were to where we are now. And that's what I am, in terms of what we are measuring in the station, as opposed to feeling when we look, you know, because as a policymaker, you base your work on measurements, evidence, which is what the DPM is also insisting, evidence-based policymaking.
All right, Julie. I was just reading a passage from the report that which says measured ambient data does not indicate any significant improvement in air quality since the gazetting of the air quality management plans. So this is what the report is saying. But otherwise, can we close the meeting? Let's not ask further questions. I think we will have another opportunity to engage.
Chair, I wanted to know the number of mines in that area. For a specific reason, I didn't ask that question because I was involved, because I didn't know it doesn't fall within the responsibility of the year. I wanted to, for Dr. Honorable Doctor, to explain to us, because we want to understand this complexity of the pollution in the particular areas. So I was expecting for her to say, we started with 10 mines in that area, and we had a problem with 10 mines. Now the volume or the number of mines have increased. That's why it seems all the efforts that we are putting to try to get the issue of pollution in that area is not working. That's what I was trying to get from her, like asking the number of licenses. Mines in that particular area, so that we can understand the complexity of the issue, so that we have the portfolio. Maybe we come up with a way of saying, look guys, we need to approach our sister department and try to speak to them. This is what we want to do in that particular area because of problem 1, 2, and 3. So that we address the issue holistically, not one department is doing this, the other department is continuing with its own thing, not knowing what the other department wants to achieve. That's what my reason for asking that question.
We maybe let's just deal with that when we get this report in August, September, about these facilities and their compliance levels and stuff like that. I'm sure we can prepare also for this question. Honorable Whip.
No, Chair, I was making a follow-up on a question that I asked, which was about administrative action. And when does the department say enough, we're now moving to criminal charges? I understand that at times there may be both, as it has been responded to. But how long is your patience? Does it take 3 years, does it take 5 years to say, this is non-compliance, we are now moving into criminal charge? When do you leave administrative action into criminal one if there's non-compliance? That's all I wanted to get to.
Okay. Quickly, before we adjourn.
There's no specific time frames. However, when we finalise the administrative process to a point we issue that final notices, and where there's non-compliance to those final notices, that automatically goes into criminal. It varies. It's case by case.
In some instances there's a series of compliances. So there's some things that they can do immediately. For example, in the next week or two or month or so, for example, we might ask them in some instances to give us a report within 30 days. So that's one aspect of the compliance. Then we'll give them another thing to do in maybe 6 months or whatever the case is. So there's different time frames for the compliance notices as well, and for them to comply with certain issues. So it is dealt with on a case-by-case basis, depending on the facility. And in some instances also, we do more than one investigation. So it's not only air quality. We do air quality, we do waste. And then we issue different sort of mini compliance notices within the one compliance notice.
Okay. All right. There's something that I wanted to ask Julie when to present it. Probably something that you can get information for us later on. Somebody told me that in a levy that Eskom applies for, the tariff, not the tariff, that Eskom applies for to the NERSA, included in that tariff, there is a levy for renewable energy that Eskom charges the customers. I wonder, because you know, I've tried to get some information on this one. I seem to be hitting the wall. Is that the case?
Chair, we will check for you and come back to you.
Okay. Please. Because the renewable energy program is a very important program in terms of the reduction of the carbon footprint. And if it is true that there is a levy on the Eskom tariff, that part of it is supposed to go to renewable energy, then we can even make a much more stronger case for the renewables. Because I'm told there is a lot of money that people are paying, and it's supposed to be ring fence for the renewable energy and for energy efficiency. So if you can just find out that for us. Okay, we've had a long meeting today. Maybe it's because the whip is back. He asked too many questions and keeps us for long here. But thank you very much, honorable members, and the staff from the department and the minister in absentia. We want to engage more on these issues of equality, truly. And I see you are not happy about the statement that you made in your medium-term review and the one that you made here, which seem to be contradictory. But let's engage more on this. we were supposed to do a follow-up in Durban also on the issues of air quality, but we don't have time. We're not going to do that. So we want to prioritize this thing as a committee. So more and more we will invite the air quality officer, national air quality officer, to come and engage with us. But we're meeting again in April, in August, September, to get that report and other reports about this one. So thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.